We'll call the order. It is 8:37, and Ms. Falks, would you please take roll?
Yes, Dr. Sinha?
Present.
Dr. Davis?
I thought it was like, yes, Dr. Sinha, or, you know, sorry. Not sorry, not too hot, is it?
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Ms. Denton?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
You have a quorum.
Okay, so next item on the agenda is just remarks and announcements. And again, as usually stated, is I wanted to thank the board staff for putting this together and reaching out to the community stakeholders. And I also want to welcome the community stakeholders as well for attending the meeting, and also thank them for taking the time to do this. Our agenda today is, we're covering statutes, rules, and we'll be discussing just behavior analysis in general in the state of Arizona. So your attendance here was important. I do appreciate you taking the time out of your day to attend. So next item, item 4, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations for revisions of the statutes that regulate the practice of behavior analysis in Arizona. Ms. Packinen, would you mind sharing your screen and as we go through this? There are any issues?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I am. There we go. I needed to find my share screen feature. Okay. All right, here we go. Does everyone see the list of the Arizona revised statutes?
Yes.
Okay, let me get actually to the BA portion. So forgive my scrolling. Sorry. Lots of psychology compact language to get past. My apologies. Okay, we should be there. Here we go. So beginning with 32-2091, your first statute, which consists of definitions.
So, committee members, did any of you have any comments or suggested changes for, I guess we'll start here and work our way through, but any at this point? Okay. Well, hearing none. Ms. Packinen, do you advise to go through section by section, or should we just address any general that we have? What are your thoughts on that?
Whatever the committee's pleasure. I think everyone sort of, saw the agenda and knew that we were going to be reviewing these. So, whatever works for this group, if there's any questions, you can ask staff, you can ask Jean, but really, let's just go section, statute by statute.
Okay. All right. So hearing none, let's move on to the next statute then.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I was trying to pull it up to make sure. In the definitions, we may want to look at, and we don't have to do it right now, but we have another agenda item that might cover this. But the definition of client, I think, might need to kind of be explored. One of the things that we've talked about a little bit over the year, and I think we're going to have continued discussion on, is what really encompasses behavior analysis, what would require licensure, those sorts of things. And I think it's housed here in client. I know some states are specifically excluding kind of the OBM type work, and I'm not sure our definition would exclude that. And so I don't know if we're presenting practice problems for OBM practitioners by including client here. And keep in mind that not all OBM practitioners are behavior analysts or are certified behavior analysts. Many of them, are just not certified, but they're practicing as OBM. They're qualified in their own way. They're just not certified. And so that might be something that we want to flag to visit. I don't know that I have any suggestions or anything right offhand right now for that, but I think that it ties nicely with one of the other agenda items.
Mr. Chair, this is Kathy.
Yes.
I was wondering if the committee wanted to consider adding a definition for you know, all the difficulty that has happened with people understanding where supervision takes place. And I wondered if you wanted to explore that in terms of a definition so that it's made more clear in the rules.
Ms. Folks, are you suggesting a definition for supervisor? We have supervisee only.
I think that is what I wasn't sure which way to go with it, just that it would be helpful if we had where the supervision takes place is the main issue. Like, because we have the rule that says a supervisor must be licensed in the state where supervision takes place. So I think I was thinking more in terms of definition of supervision, but a definition of supervisor. This is why I don't know which way to go, but I thought I'd bring it up for the committee to think about.
And one thing that I need to take a look at along with that is the bill, Senate Bill 1253, which is the resurrected House Bill 2224 that did not pass last year, last session, due to the abrupt ending of the session. We're adding statute language that addresses the supervision piece. I'm pulling up the bill right now. Sorry, lots of scrolling. Almost there. The new language in 3220.91.03 will say, if the experience was obtained in a state that licensed behavior analysts at the time of the supervised work experience, the supervisor must be licensed in the state where the behavior analysis trainee services were provided.
Oh, perfect. That's what we need. Okay.
Okay.
So it's addressed already.
Okay.
No, I wasn't sure.
Committee members, any other comments in that section? Okay, let's move on to the next section then. Any comments on this section?
Just by way of explanation, this statute just allows the broad authority to charge fees, and then the fees are specified in the rules.
Okay. Any comments on 0.02? All right, let's move on to the next one then. What about this one?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have two things with this. One is, and we've historically tried to remove it before, we have a little bit, I think, of a different circumstance now to remove it, but the prescribed 1500 hours is written into here. And the two issues that I have with this is, one, recently the full board had a sunset audit, and this was a point of contention for the auditors in that they felt that this was too prescriptive for typical statutory language. And that in that, that this should be in rule and not statute, the 1500 hours was kind of the feedback that they gave. They said that they looked into other national statutes around this. They looked at other types of licensing boards, and they felt that having 1500 hours in statute was too prescriptive. Now, the benefit of that kind of notion coming forward is this has been something that as behavior analysts, we've advocated for removal of this since inception. This has been something that Dr. Davey and I have sat before the board on more than one occasion with Dr. Davidson to try to articulate to the board why this prescriptive language is problematic. So I think we have a little bit now because we have another, you know, kind of auditing process saying, this is a little bit prescriptive. The other thing is that the BACB has now set this as their minimum. So moving forward, the only people that would be able to, if we were to change this language, and we can change, add it to rule if that's what the board sees fit. But the only people that would be affected by this and in a positive light would be those that have been practicing for years. So take, for instance, an individual who did their 750 hours of intensive practicum out of, let's just say, FIT, and they have been practicing for 8 years. They're a clinical director, a regional director. As of right now, they can't get licensed in Arizona because they don't meet this statutory requirement. But if we change this, I think the nature of this 1500 hours was out of concern and probably an overabundance of concern that, newly certified and newly licensed individuals wouldn't meet a standard that's consistent with our like fields. So in psychology, it's 3000 hours in counseling, it's 3000 hours. So that was kind of the issue. But now if we were to remove this language, one, the BACB has now changed it to 1500 as the minimum. It's no longer 750 and 1000. But if we remove this language, we take away that prescriptive authority, put it back in the rulemaking process. So we would have to have a rule to go with it, and we can align that more with the BACB piece. But that I think would satisfy one, the recommendations of the sunset audit, but two, the concerns we've had for years, and three, the fact that the BACB has now increased their requirements. And then because of that, we would also need to change, and I don't think we did it in the current bill, but we would also need to change supervised experience, independent field work, university practicum, intensive university practicum to, again, not be so prescriptive because those have now changed in their titles of what they're being called. And so when you look at the rules, people, I think, get confused and they say, oh, but the BACB doesn't have or isn't going to have a university practicum anymore, but we have to keep it in rules if it's in statute. So I think we need to kind of broaden this section a little bit, not make it so prescriptive, and add the prescribed portions of it into rule.
So, Dr. Wilson, I mean, I think when I read it, I redlined what was essentially following the statement, sorry, I'm looking at my red line, and on the one that's being displayed, it's line 1, 2, 3, three quarters of the way through line 4, there's a comma after BACB, except the number of hours. Essentially, I feel like we could strike starting at except all the way down to practicum and just get rid of that clause. So can you highlight that for us, Spackanon, starting at except? On your document?
Yes, Dr. Davey.
All the way to practicum. And then as I was reading, the next sentence really appears to me to be a repeat of the sentence right above. So I think it must just be restating what was, I don't understand why we have that twice, because that's already said in the sentence above. Mm-hmm. So I think that could probably be stricken as well, unless I'm missing some reason why we have that. And I think cleaning up the 1500 hours, again, it gives us, you know, it's like, what is nationally recognized that allows us to say those standards are consistent with that. So I suspect that over time, the BAT will continue to ratchet up the number of hours. I think that Dr. Wexler and Dr. Bohansky and others on the board had a very good point when they spoke to the behavior analyst saying, you know, 750 is definitely not 1500. And we're already concerned at 1500 not being enough, given what you guys are going to be tasked with in the community. And so to me, you know, this was a pain point, but we reached out to the BACB. They did not have data to back up that a 750 was equal to a 1500. And so it was really, you know, at that point, moot. And so this would be my suggestion for it. I don't really have an opinion one way or the other about it going to rules versus statute. I mean, I think, you know, that I'll leave that to Gene perhaps and Heidi to discuss and maybe with the rulemakers, but I think cleaning this up makes a lot of sense.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I agree with you. I think the basis of my comments around that is we still have to take this to the board. And we're fortunate that, one, we did ask for that data and then wasn't produced, but lo and behold, increased standards came out of shortly later. But I think that for me, it's just discussion points to be able to present to the board why we're removing this, because we still have to get, after we discuss this and talk with stakeholders and what have you, we still have to get this approved. And I think Dr. Malott's the only board member that is historically aware of this process, but I think it is important for them to remember that the Sunset audit found this to be an abnormally prescriptive section for statute.
It is long. I mean, I agree. So, I mean, I think by cutting that out, you know, it still gives us the wiggle room that if all of a sudden the BACB adopts something crazy, like you have to be 6 foot tall and have red hair to become, you know, certified, that we can deviate from that. So, you know, I don't know if Ms. Galvin has any concerns about it, but to me, this seems to be a relic of years past.
This is Jean. It's similar to what the psychology board statutes read, that they have to have no less than 3,000 hours in, you know, whether it's pre-internship, internship, or postdoc. So that's the opinion of the auditor general, and that's fine. I don't believe that it's overly prescriptive, but that's going to be up to the committee to make a recommendation to the board. It's similar to psychology.
I'm comfortable with this edit if others are.
Dr. Davis-Wilson, Dr. Davey, would the prescription be in the rules then? Is that what you're suggesting? And then how easy is it to change the rules if the BACB somehow changes things? Or are we comfortable with the 1500 hours?
I mean, I think a minimum of 1500 hours is fine. I do believe the BACB over time will continue to ratchet that up as part of their long-term plan. It'll just take time as a field to probably get to where a 3000 hour practicum is even doable, given the rush to get people into the workforce and the current academic structure to support such endeavors. I mean, we know from the psychologist side, getting someone through a 3000 hour practicum experience is difficult. And Dr. Wohansky led one of the largest programs, if not the largest program in the country, now Dr. Malott does, to make that happen. And so it takes a lot of a lift to get there. So I think it's going to take time for the BACB to do that. That being said, I think this allows us to go forward with the BACB as they ratchet up those hours. I don't, you know, we can go back to the rules and make sure that there's not another discussion of the 15 or the less than 1500 or more than 1500 hours or equal to 1500 hours and strike that as well.
Well, I think that's a good, I think procedurally, I think it's good for everybody on the call to maybe understand what'll happen procedurally is that we wouldn't be able to even touch the rules as is for those sections. We wouldn't be able to change until the statute change goes into effect. Mm-hmm. Because we can't have a discrepancy between the rules and the statute. And so even though we're going to look at the rules today, the rules specific to supervised experience can't be changed until after the whole statute process has kind of worked its way through. Now, let's say that the statute worked its way through and effective July 1st, which is not going to be how quickly it works its way through, but just for way of example, July 1st, this statute's changed to the edits that we recommended. And she's noisy today. Sorry. So let's say that the statute change and we're ready, then we would have to do a request. I believe that the governor still has rule writing under request, but we would have to do a request to change the rules, to open a rule writing package, and then start that process. In general, changing rules is easier. She really likes this conversation, by the way, guys. Changing rules is easier than changing statute, but I'm not necessarily suggesting we put this in the rules. That can be something we can talk about afterwards. I'm just suggesting that might be a better place for it. But yes, so anything, so we could, if we felt it necessary to make a rule package now, because things needed to change now, we could, but we wouldn't be able to change any rules that have statutes in place that differ from this. So to change this section of our rules, we have to get through the statutory process first.
So in terms of the rules, you're correct in terms of procedure. I think Ms. Galvin and Ms. Pacquiao would agree. You know, really the rules section is our 426 404.2, the supervised experience requirement. And that's where we do have the 1500 hour requirement, and it references back to ARS 32.2091.03 right here where we're at today. So we would need to go back and clean that up. But the larger point I'd like to make with regard to the recommendation from the audit, I feel like it's in the rules. Once this, you know, once we make this cleanup here and clean up as part of the rules package, the supervised experience requirement, I think it's codified in both places. And I think that's fine. And I think, you know, barring some disagreement that Ms. Galvin thinks we don't need it in one, but just need it in the other, I think we leave it.
And I also think the statement that says, you know, if the board disagrees, because that's the bigger piece, their biggest concern historically has been, what if tomorrow 500 hours is acceptable? And so we have in several places in both statutory language as well as rule language, that bottom statement of, if the board disagrees, they can adopt a new standard. And that's just that kind of safeguard. We believe that the BACB is going to continue to increase. And I foresee a day where 3,000 hours, like our similar, you know, professions, will be required. I think that it's coming, you know, maybe 10 years from now, maybe more, but I think it's coming. But I think that there's other professions that have had slight setbacks in their standards, and that's where their concern is.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I certainly don't want to speak on behalf of the certification board, but the conversations that I had with Ms. Bloom, with Misty Bloom, as I was sort of, you know, ramping up my knowledge about their process. They are sensitive and aware of the fact that state boards require a period of time to promulgate new rules. So anytime their requirements change, I think they will do the best that they can to, you know, recognizing that it could take 2 years before we're able to adjust our rules accordingly. So I don't think that we're going to find, you know, that they will surprise state boards, and state boards are sort of, you know, scrambling to catch up and to make their changes.
Yeah. And I think part of it's us just cleaning up that language to that point. Like, I think when we historically, as we put this together, we were dealing with kind of being the new kids on the block, wanting to make sure we're protecting the public, making sure that we were, that the board in general was comfortable with the nationally recognized behavior analyst certification board. I think we're kind of past that infancy at this particular point. You know, we're still kind of toddlerish, but I think we're kind of past those concerns. That, you know, the BACB continues to hold itself out as a reputable organization. They continue to dial up requirements and things to be able to maintain their certifications. And so I think a lot of that is kind of gone by the wayside for the board and for the leadership of the board. And so to that point, I think, again, I think we're all saying the same thing, clean up the language and the statutes, and then we'll have to go back. And I think we make the rules much more general to be in line with what we have in the statutes, that we're going to adopt standards consistent with the BACB, and that we hold, you know, we hold out the right that should we disagree with something, we can adopt an alternative.
All right, thank you. Any other comments on this statute? Okay, and a question of order. Do we need to make motions for these changes to go before the board, or are we able just to submit them? That might be Ms. Galvin's.
I think, and I'm sure staff is keeping track of the changes, and at the end of the review of the statutes, we can take a motion. Heidi can review what was recommended and then make a motion to recommend to the board that the proposed statutes be changed in the manner that is outlined.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I also have a question for just point of order, and perhaps Ms. Galvin can help us. So part of, we have a statute that solicits that stakeholder feedback. We've invited stakeholders to be on this call. Formality, like process, what would be the best way to engage those members on the call? Is it something that the chair would have the discretion to ask at any time? Do we go through this and then, you know, see if they have anything? I know it's a little bit different than like a typical call to the public, but what would you suggest we do to ensure that we're still engaging that stakeholder feedback since we do have those members on the call?
You could seek stakeholder input at the end of your discussion about the statutes, and then at the end of your discussion about the rules, or when you have finished a substantive discussion like you just did here. While we're hot on the topic, you could ask if there's any comment from any of the stakeholders. Maybe they have a suggestion that could, you know, inform your recommendation one way or the other.
Thank you.
Unless there's any objections, I would prefer the latter. So as we discuss each statute as a committee, at the conclusion of that statute, I'd like to open it up to the stakeholders for further comment. Are there any objections to that? Okay. So stakeholders, any further comments on this statute?
No comments. I agree with cleaning up the language.
I agree. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No comments. This specific change, I remember early on, was very controversial, or this item here was very controversial. So I actually am really appreciative to see it being stricken from statute, possibly.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jean Galvin. I would ask that individual stakeholders provide their name prior to their comment, just so the minutes can accurately reflect who is making comments.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. This is Brian Van Roten. I made the first comment.
And Carrie Baranek.
All right, Ms. Packham, let's look at the next one. All right. Committee members, any discussion on this? Stakeholders, any comments?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question for Ms. Galvin, possibly Ms. Pakanon. Is this language fine keeping in there given the universal recognition? And we don't really have a reciprocity, so it's kind of a funky, we've kind of talked about it in the past, but is this language, does it make a difference whether we keep it or don't? Or is this something that we've already in the other package addressed?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davis-Wilson, if I may, Kathy Folks and I have had a couple of conversations very recently, last night, as a matter of fact, relative to this statute. We see it as a potential conduit to accomplish kind of what you were describing in the discussion of the previous statute, which is allowing an application and licensure pathway for BAs from other jurisdictions with experience. You made the point accurately that we do not have a rule currently that outlines specifically what this pathway may look like, but it seems that you have this authority. So the questions and that you may have, maybe we want to craft a really good rule. We didn't have a good rule previously, and that's why it was repealed. So maybe that's the conversation happens at that time. I'm not certain.
I guess for, go ahead, Ms. Galvin.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I guess for me, I'm just, the universal recognition kind of for me also covers this.
This is Jean, and I'm not sure I would equate this reciprocity statute with universal recognition, because this statute says by a regulatory agency of another state that imposes requirements that are substantially equivalent. And under universal recognition, you don't look into the requirements by that other state. You don't make a determination that the requirements are substantially equivalent. You just look to see if they have a valid license and have established residency here, et cetera. So I think that I would not equate reciprocity with universal recognition.
I think that I do agree with Ms. Galvin. I think that we've wanted to do just that because, acknowledging we weren't really activating, if you will, this statute and this possibility. I did bring up to the universal recognition numbers, and they're pretty low. So that statute has existed now for about a year and a half. We only, you've only granted licensure to 10 behavior analysts under universal recognition. We do have, eight. And then you have three other applications that are pending. And I think what's problematic about universal recognition is the requirement of the residency. I think that, for some that works, but I think for other professionals, that sequence of events doesn't work for them. Residency and then the license and then the job offer. For many professionals, the license and the job offer are kind of, important first in order to make the transition to Arizona residency. So I don't know that it's accomplishing what we want to accomplish.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is Kathy. In addition to what Heidi said, the other issue is that many VAs, especially after this year, are seeking to do remote supervision, but they must be licensed in Arizona. The universal recognition pathway does not work. And then we eliminate a lot of experienced BCBAs due to the BACB's practice of destroying training records after 7 years. And so it's very difficult. I'm running into quite a few applicants who want to get a license in Arizona, can't do it by universal recognition, they're not moving here, and can't get their training records. They didn't keep them, no one kept them. And the BACB does not bank credentials like that, like other professions do. So they are stuck. They are unable to verify their 1500 hours.
Ms. Peckman, I thought of the residency thing right before you said it, and I agree. I think that that's one caveat of universal recognition that that makes it a little bit harder. And this would allow even like regional directors and remote supervisors and things like that. How does that work with regard to our certification and licensure? So this says licensed or certified by a state regulatory. The only state that certifies is Pennsylvania. All others have licenses. 31 others have licenses. So does this still mean that an individual coming from California or, you know, one of those non-licensed states would not have access to reciprocity? Okay. I was just trying to figure it out, the language in my head.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davis-Wilson, this was one of the things Heidi and I were talking about. Can you hear me okay? I'm just not seeing.
Yeah.
Okay. The with the temporary license, if you'll recall, the decision was made to allow applicants to have their BCBA certification act as their license or be equivalent to when they're in a state that doesn't offer licensure. I had wondered if there was a possibility that the committee would consider using a verification of independent practice and their BCBA certification for states where licensure does not exist. We could create a verification of independent practice based on whatever you want to see in a verification, but it may act as an equivalent for supervised experience when those supervised experience records are not available anymore.
I think that's a really neat idea. Would that be something though that would be done in the rule writing process?
I believe so.
Can I ask just a quick question? So, I mean, when I look at this, I get it. So we've got someone who perhaps became a BCBA back in the dark ages when Dr. Stenhoff did, and they did not have their records to show that they either did not do an intensive practicum. Is that what we're trying to protect against, is someone who would have done 750? Because if Dr. Stenhoff, according to the BACB registry, was certified in 2003, 2004, 2005, I forget, Dr. Stenhoff, when you were certified. Okay. It says when the original certificate came through. And so is it really necessary for much more than that, now that we understand that they've had that original certification? Is the question just simply, did you do it with 750 hours or with what we've had in the past of 1500?
Dr. Davey, I don't think that it necessarily, I mean, it would cover that by potential essence, but possibly not, because right now, the way the statute's written, the 1500 is required. So we would have to say substantially equivalent would mean they would still have to have done the 1500 hours.
Which I think, in my opinion, if they brought forward a BACB certification that we then verified was, you know, in 1999, and attested that they did 1500 hours, to me, I think that would be enough to move forward.
Well, I agree. And I think that's what Ms. Folks is suggesting, is that maybe we look at our rules for the documentation, because right now our documentation, it's either you go the universal recognition path where your only documentation is residency, or no disciplinary action in other jurisdictions and a year's worth of licensure in another jurisdiction, or you have to go through the full application process, which requires those supervision forms. And that's what she's talking about, is there's a group of people that are struggling to get access to the supervision documentation because of how long it's been since they were supervised. And so she's suggesting potential language that I think would fall under rules that would do exactly what you're suggesting, is say what would be those requirements to kind of bypass the supervision piece. And she's suggesting, you know, maybe an independent practice at a station that that shows that they've been in an independent practice for a prescribed amount of time or what have you. But that it's not so much, I mean, it could potentially, especially if the other statute chains open it up for those that have done some of the 750 hours or what have you. But the issue right now is that proof of supervision is required in the rules. And there's this population of people that are struggling with meeting that requirement.
I guess what I'm thinking is that, you know, maybe there's a way that Ms. Galvin could help us think of a comment that, you know, obviously board rules as well as BACB rules keep records for 7 years. If that 7 years has lapsed, that we could have an attestation that would serve. Because if they lie on the attestation, one, that's immediately goes to good moral character if that's ever found, license revoked, and would also go to the BACB, most likely lead down their disciplinary path as well. But I think if we create that path for those that are, you know, if that documentation is not available and is past the 7 year date from the time of application, that we would move beyond that.
Mr. And we can look at a way to address that in rule, something like an attestation or, you know, an obligation on the applicant to maintain the records despite a time limitation from the national board.
Ms. Galvin, I do believe we have that in rule already for the records. And I think that that's something that I had numerous conversations with Dr. Olvey about. And Dr. Olvey brought up a good point of really as behavior analysts, even though the certification board's saying 7 years, we really should hold on to our, those training records forever. And that's what, happens with psychology or tries to happen with psychology. Because each state has different guidelines around it. So it makes for difficulties when you're relocating. But I think that the issue is that even that seven year retention rule from the national board didn't go into effect until 2014. So I think that, and prior to that, the BACB did everything by snail mail, I didn't apply online through a portal and like everybody gets to do now, scan in their stuff. Like I had to mail everything in. So I think that there's like this population of people that are being adversely affected. And I had this conversation with the board in the past. I had this conversation with Dr. Olvey. And so I know what the previous board member's opinion on the matter is, but I still think that even to Ms. Folk's point, like we're still running into this where people who've been probably, researchers and people who have great practice, records are potentially not able to practice in Arizona. And I see, I see some of the other side of the story, but we've got a very young population and it kills me to turn away these experienced qualified folks.
Which is a benefit to the behavior analyst across the state to have that experience coming in here and being able to do that. And
Mr. Chair, this is Kathy.
Yeah.
Just as an FYI, pardon me. The psychologists accept independent licensure for 10 years or more as a qualifier to waive verifying 1,500 hours of supervised experience. And then at the 20-year mark, where they've been licensed for 20 years, the psychology board, or the psychologists may waive verification of all supervised experience. So in effect, they are accepting independent practice in lieu of supervised experience. And Gene will know this better than I anymore, but the DO board where I used to work also has a similar equivalent. There's an equivalent of independent practice versus, I forget what it is actually, because it's been a few years now, but it's not uncommon. Especially, and I think that the VAs have a especially difficult time getting licensed with our requirements, because of that BACB rule of destroying training records. And I just wonder if the committee would want to consider using or creating a verification of independent practice beyond licensure if you wanted to, where an employer would have to verify that experience, since someone could be holding onto a license but not practicing. I don't know, it's just a thought I wanted to just offer.
The concern I have with the evidence of practice is what would that look like? So if you have a person who owns their own LLC, what would be, or what are some examples of evidence of practice that are provided to a licensing board, such as Arizona?
As I recall with the DO board, we had a form that had to be filled out by, if they own their own practice, then they have a third party, either a partner or a colleague that's familiar with their practice, that they, you know, work closely together, can fill out that verification form. And basically they were just verifying that this person has been in you know, full-time independent practice from this start date to this end date. And we know by their license verification that they're in good standing, but we don't have that option for a state that doesn't offer licensure. But I think the BCBA certification that's in good standing would stand in lieu of that for those folks.
Is that documentation the form of an affidavit, or is it just
it's like a verification form, like yours, the supervision okay. verification form?
Okay. So, committee, any thoughts, further thoughts on that?
I think it's a great idea. I think if board staff wouldn't mind making a note about bringing this back up during rule writing, I think if we kept this as is and then looked at the rule writing, because we're going to have to do rule writing even if that other bill goes through there, I think there's some rules that will be required to have some changes. And so I think it's a great discussion for the rule writing portion, and potentially just to bring back up when we're ready to tackle it.
And another question I have, we don't accept reciprocity, or we don't have reciprocity. Is this statute, is this necessary to keep on the book at this time, or is it just a nice placeholder to have just in case?
Mr. Chair, just if I can chime in, I don't think I would recommend not rushing in to propose eliminating this authority. I think it's good to have just in case some of the other strategies that seem to be emerging from this conversation. If those strategies don't work out for whatever reason, then you still have this authority, and maybe we can go back to the drawing board and figure out how to leverage it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Any further comments from committee? Okay, stakeholders.
Hi, this is Jessica Reese, and I just wanted to add in information. With other boards, like the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, this is probably the most contested issue that they face on a day-to-day basis. So I work at an organization where we're frequently trying to bring in LCSWs, LMFTs, the way that board handles it is very case by case, very difficult. It's extremely difficult to get out of state licensees into our state. And so I would just caution that I think this is a very important piece within our statutes and rule sets to be very clear how we would either provide reciprocity to other states or how we would handle people coming in. So I don't know if it's possible at all to look at maybe saying your BACB certificate could certify a certain number of hours based on the year that you were certified, or something of that nature, that could stand as proof of a certain number of hours. But I think, you know, we really, really struggle with the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners and getting out of state people licensed in our state. So I think going forward, this would be very important.
Ms. Reese, Mr. Chair, if I may, Ms. Reese, I do have a question for you. Have you noticed that that has changed at all with universal recognition? So if they're like licensed, because you're dealing with people who consistently have licensure in other states, but if you've got like a licensed social worker or licensed counselor coming in from California, and obviously they're relocating because you guys are located here in Arizona, are you finding that they're, even with the universal recognition where quite literally all that's required is residency and proof of licensure for a year, are you guys still running into that issue?
I think it's the same issue that we would run into for people that aren't necessarily here for a year or that have proof of residency. And so I think earlier, I can't remember if it was Ms. Galvin or Ms. Folks who had said, you know, that people who are out of state that may not have the residency or who may only be here part time of the year or who may be providing, especially with all of the telehealth considerations that are coming out now and the ability to use telehealth. We actually have an employee that lives in South Dakota right now who does some oversight into some of our rural site programs, who is not a behavior analyst. She's an LPC, but it really creates, you know, and I think that kudos to all of the behavior analysts across the United States who have kind of come together around a common, you know, theme with the behavior analyst certification board. But I think what we're seeing here in our state is that they're very far away from, you know, we're kind of, to use Dr. Davies' stance, we were kind of in our infancy, where some of the other boards have moved away from, you know, each state kind of stands alone. And so I think, you know, we could put some language in there that would work and that would stand and would make this very easy for decision-making going forward. And I don't think it has to be a lot of language, and it could be something very basic and easy, but I think we do need to retain our ability to be the decision makers at the table about how people coming in from out of state are handled, or people that continue to live out of state.
So committee members, would this be entertained in the rules or, okay, all right, so we'll.
Yeah, I think that this is still broad enough, Mr. Chair, and I think exactly to what Mrs. Reese is saying, and exactly to those points, I think Kathy captured them still, and it really just comes down to kind of the documentation requirement, that if we had that kind of caveat around the documentation for where supervision is a problem, and we outline that so it's clear and consistent. I can't speak to what other boards are doing, but I can say that one of the things that I like about this board in particular and the guidance that we get from Ms. Galvin is, you know, we aren't a big fan of those gray areas that are case by case all the time. Obviously complaints and things like that have to be case by case, but when it comes to like the application process, I think most of us have fought really hard to have that consistency. And so what I would suggest, because like I said, in order for us to tackle this and rule, it'll take another meeting at a later time, but just continuing to engage those stakeholders. Cause like to Ms. Reese's point, she works in, you know, a multidisciplinary clinic where there's lots of different professions. And so that insight of how it's working or not working on the front lines is good information to have.
Okay, thank you. Any other points or discussion on this?
Yeah, this is Carrie Baranek. I have a question. Was the thought behind the attestation for anyone over 7 years? And forgive me if I missed the time period that we were speaking about. And is that time frame built primarily around the certification board's practices of retaining or not retaining records after 7 years? I guess my question is that the right way to make that timeline decision?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think we were just throwing out numbers as examples. I think that when we go to the rule writing discussion, we would have a more substantial conversation. And then I think we have to look at the language that the psychologists are using to make sure that if we are going to differ from theirs, that we're able to articulate why. I think like the 7-year, you know, retention as a purpose, I kind of agree isn't maybe the best way to make the decision per se. But it sounds like the psychology board has like a 10-year and then a 20-year kind of guideline. And so if we differ from that, we would want to be able to have rationale that makes sense to public protection. But I don't think at this point there's any, like, all of that would still be open to full discussion when we talk about changing those rules. We talk about the rule language at a, probably a later date. We'll cover a little bit of the rules today, but I think that's when we can really probably come to a consensus of what that year would be and have an understanding of what we're going to present. Cause we, Dr. Davey and I would still have to, and board staff, take it to the board and say, here's what we're doing and why. And I don't know that the why being that the BACB allows for the disposal of records at 7 years is going to really weigh into public protection. But if we were to say something like, well, we want to do 10 years because we recognize people move and people relocate and blah, 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 blah. Oh, and by the way, that's the same for the, you know, psychologist applicants, something like that might be a better articulation. But either way, I think we were just throwing out numbers as just examples for right now. So if you guys as stakeholders, you know, want to sit on it and think about it and provide feedback to that when we get back to the rule writing, like I think that's like very open right now. Like everything was just kind of hypothetical at this point.
This is Brian Van Merton. And as I mentioned, I just wanted to let you know I'm going to have to depart, but I did want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for allowing this forum. It's really, really neat to collaborate. Dr. Davey, I'll make up the rest of the time by offering to meet you at Disneyland at some point. So you all have a wonderful weekend.
You too. Good to see you, Brian.
Good to see you all.
Yeah, I would just say about this discussion to kind of put a pin on it. I think the psychologists provide us with some good language that as we kind of continue to look through this, you know, I was just kind of clicking through a few of the items. And essentially, one of the things that they list is that the individual is registered essentially as a psychologist with the National Registry of Behavioral Health Professionals. Does that sound right, Heidi? I mean, essentially, we could, in terms of ways we could look for someone being active, you know, I don't know what that registry looks like, but that to me sounds like that could be equivalent to the BACB certification, or it could be a QACH, like have they been essentially enrolled as an active provider of behavioral analytics services as a QHP. And so I think there's probably some things we can learn from how the psychologists look at this as we kind of move forward and kind of what they've outlined. It even looks like, you know, being a diplomat in the psychology. I mean, it could be professional memberships, right? If for the last 10 years, you've been a member of ABAI, APBA, ASIABA, like those sorts of things may be the evidence that they have been involved in practice. So maybe we can just kind of look at that, you know, as we move forward. Dr. Stenhoff, are you still there?
Yeah, Ms. Packinon, let's go ahead and look at the next one. Use button.
Darn thing.
Yeah. Any comments on this section?
I really have very rare temporary licenses. Ms. Packinon, how many temporary licenses have we ever put through?
Oh,
not very many, right? I mean, it's
Brady, I'd have to defer to Ms. Folks. In 13 months, I think I've yet to see a temporary application from a behavior analyst, but Ms. Folks, I'm sure, has better perspective than me.
I just don't think it's something that's a very common mechanism for us. And this language, as I remember, is directly aligned with that of the psychologist. So I think if this is one we can move on from, unless other committee members feel differently or the public.
Other comments? Stakeholders? Okay, back on, let's move on to the next.
Mr. Chair, I took a moment with that discussion to look at our registry. The emergency temporary licenses, we have less than 30 for the BAs, and we don't offer a temporary license at all otherwise, just the emergency one.
Okay, so look at 0.07. Any comments on this one?
No, I mean, all of that still holds true, right? I'm just backing on that it's still like on the birthday, like none of that's changed. I don't know that there was any other areas that have really been modified. There was one piece of language, and I don't know how to correct it because I don't know that I know. I guess I could probably, we could ask Misty Bloom. But in D, we reference a state licensing or disciplinary board or disciplinary actions or sanctions imposed by a state or National Behavior Analysis Ethics Committee. I don't know if what the National Behavior Ethics Committee is.
Dr. Davey, that is who still sanctions the behavior analysts. It comes from the BACB, but it's their ethics committee. Mm-hmm. So when they send over the documentation, it's coming from their ethics committee review for disciplinary.
Is it still called that though, or has it? I'm gonna look at an email I have.
The most recent documentation that I have received from them was very similar language. Yes.
Just for clarification, that is all under the roof of the BACB, correct? It's not a separate entity.
Right. They have an ethics and disciplinary kind of team.
Yeah, hold on, I'm logging on to my BACB email.
So a question for that is, I know there was some intent on some of the vague language in the statute, but would it make sense to move that to, instead of National Behavior Analysis Ethics Committee, would it be the Behavior Analyst Certification Board Ethics Committee, or do we want to keep it that vague?
I'm just wondering, who's to say that that's, I mean, from what I understand, that could be a department, that could be a committee, that could be multiple things. Maybe it just needs to say imposed by the, just like the language you've used in other places, behavior the BACB essentially, right? Behavior Analytics Certification Board versus their actual ethics committee, because it is an umbrella, and who's to say that that committee, that's now, it could be the code for all we know committee, right? I mean, they could have, they could change their name to be something more in line with their nuances of the week. So maybe just bringing it back to the national level, unless Ms. Galvin has particular issues around that. Because right now, okay, so I'm on a BACB portal, and it's determined, like their terminology now is the BACB Ethics Department. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it may have been a committee previously. Now they have quite a workforce as that group. Those of you that may serve as SMEs or subject matter experts or for their for any of their projects, or if you work as a ethics coach, you kind of see the same things I'm looking at So maybe I would be more apt to back that out and suggest that we just put it at that national level of the BACB.
And to just clarify, though, I don't think in statute we have the BACB. I think the language is just National Certifying Board. And then in rule, we specify the BACB.
In statute, we list the National Behavior Analytics Certifying. Like, we don't say the term BACB, but we spell it out almost every single time in statute.
In rule or statute, Dr. Davey?
In statute. We just, one of the very first statutes we looked at today has it listed out multiple times.
All right, so do we want to note a change for that to the committee?
I would agree. I think that that makes sense, and it does account for if they change the name, as Dr. Davey suggested, from Ethics Department to Ethics Committee. It allows flexibility and it's still covered.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my input would be if there's other statutory revisions that you're seeking, this one just seems like a simple, straightforward one to tack on with the more substantive changes that you would potentially request.
Okay.
And the language we used, Heidi, and it is what we did in the educational and training standard. It reads Nationally Recognized Behavior Analyst Certification Board.
Got it.
So I think we go imposed by a state. I mean, I don't think it is a state. It's probably imposed by, if the state's there, because it'd be another state jurisdiction such as ourself. But I mean, I'm gonna read that actually, because it's the licensee or other state licensing or disciplinary board or sanctions imposed by, yeah, I think it's sanctions imposed by a nationally recognized behavior analyst certification board. Mm-hmm. Or healthcare institution. I think healthcare institution has to stay there. And where it says sanctioning agency in the last section, Ms. Galvin, more of a question, is it a sanction? Is it, are all of those agencies or are they bodies? You know, what is agency capture that correctly?
Does a language capture that correctly?
It says the report shall have the name and address of the sanctioning agency. But it, like, for example, are we an agency or are we a body? Is agency all encompassing?
I think that's sufficient.
Okay. Thank you.
Other comments from the committee? Stakeholders, any other comments or any comments? Okay. So Ms. Packanon, let's move on to the next.
You know, I just have one comment here, and I actually have multiple comments, but I'm going to make one of them that I think drives me nuts a little bit, and that's under exemption one. Employed in the common school, right, high school, and it was certified. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I do wish we could put something there that they are not, you know, without licensure, however, they cannot supervise. because that they are not, if they're not, if they're, you know, that does not get them out of that. And I don't know where that goes. I don't know if it goes here, but as I said in the last CBA that we had, I was so pleasantly surprised that the teachers that were overseeing other teachers in the Gumby CBAs were all licensed. And I do wonder if we're to the point of, like, do we need that exemption? Should not a behavior analyst, whether they're in a school setting or not, need to be licensed by this board? And they're still practicing. They are still engaged in behavior analysis. And I'm sure, you know, I know Dr. Davis Wilson and Dr. Davidson and probably yourself, Dr. Stenhoff Dr. Rates were around for some of those conversations of why we have that there. There are times where it's problematic in my view, and confuses potential applicants. And so so I kind of leave that there. I don't know that there's much we can do about it, but I did at least want to make a comment.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Dr. Davey, here's my issue with that particular language, is that language does say, and is certified by the Department of Education. And what we've seen is this to be interpreted as, I work in the schools, therefore I'm exempt. And that's not what this language says. This language says, and certified by the Department of Education. And the nature of where this came from is it came from the exemption in the psychology board, the psychologist language. And the psychologist language says this because there is such a thing as a school psychologist that is certified by the Department of Education. And so in their language, they had it in there to capture those school psychologists of which they don't have authority over. And so in the early rule writing, this was just something that came over with the kind of crosswalk of like, well, here's how psychologist has exemptions. Let's plop it in and then let's edit it. And I don't think that, I think that people found value in, okay, if you work in the school and getting those services in the school, I think the piece that stumps me is that and piece, because so many people are in the school saying, well, I work in the school and therefore, and I think you're right. Those that are teachers, they're certified by the Department of Education and thus may not need to also have a license. But I think those ones would also be covered under B, which says the article does not prevent other recognized professions whose license, certified, or regulated under the laws from the state from rendering the services within that scope of practice. So I think a teacher who is a BCBA would still be exempt under B. I think the problem comes, like I said, the nature of the language was about school psychologists. And I don't think that it crosswalks over to behavior analysis because it creates that confusion. And then we're running into, and what we're seeing is people in the schools, they're one, potentially practicing without a license for the fact that they are not certified in by the Department of Education. And two, they, because they don't understand, again, that says, and it doesn't say, or, and two, they're supervising others. And so we're getting those applicants coming in and we're not able to count those applicants' hours because their supervisor wasn't licensed. So I struggle with articulating why that language would need to be in there. If B captures the population that you're talking about. B would capture those teachers, a speech pathologist, a school. There's a school psychologist that we have here in Arizona that's a BCBA. There's a couple of them.
Yeah. Again, I too have struggled with that for a long time. Like I understand we did not want to, I think back in the day, we did not want to create a hiccup in the educational system and all of a sudden, create potential issues for behavior analysts that were in schools and add another layer and so on and so forth. And we didn't want to take away from the services that, children with exceptionalities required. But to your point, B captures a certified special education teacher who may also be a BCBA. I think that I do believe that this is a carryover from the psychology language and may not align with current practice as behavior analysts in the state of Arizona. The second one is also kind of odd to me as well, but we can get to that one later. So I don't know, Ms. Galvin, I guess part of that comes back to you and if you recall any particular reason or if this is strictly just a carryover or do we not have jurisdiction to touch someone who's in the Department of Education? I'd be interested in your take on that.
Yeah. I'm not sure if she's back. Ms. Galvin had to step out for a quick break, so we may have to circle back to your question, Dr. Davey.
That's fine. Any comment then on number two, employee or government agency subordinate position? The word assistant.
Dr. Davey, just a quick note. I don't know historically or legally, but in number one as well, is there a reason that private schools are excluded from that list?
I think because the Department of Education doesn't require certifications for private schools. Correct. And so okay. Like, and is the key piece there is you have to be certified by the Department of Education.
Yeah. So okay. That uses charter schools and then our local public schools. Does not.
Okay, so somebody that is working for a private school would need to be licensed in order to practice because if they're in fact not certified by the Department of Ed. Okay.
And that would be the same for the other schools. Before we move on to number two, if I may, we do have Ms. Reese, I think, still on the phone, and she was a part of actually the very original language development. Perhaps, I just don't want to overlook if there's something that was discussed in the original conversations back in 2009, she may have some historical knowledge on that. Sorry to put you on the
spot. Yeah, no, it's fine. I think originally when we were looking at it, there were people that were working in the school setting as teachers who were potentially participating in development of functional behavior assessments. And so at that time, there was some concern about kind of people who hadn't potentially pursued BCBA certification, but, you know, maybe functioning in some certain capacities. And so originally it was kind of the idea that as soon as we move over to licensure, then practicing behavior analysis without a license becomes extremely problematic and goes against statute. And so what were people at schools able to continue to do without licensure? But I think, again, kind of to echo what Dr. Davey had said earlier, I think we've probably moved beyond some of this. And I think Carrie had also said it, that, you know, I think some of this language was originally there just to kind of help people who weren't going to pursue licensure, but still were going to have some functions in schools that could down the road get bucketed into practicing behavior analysis. But I really think we're probably beyond that point now and kind of probably where you're saying that we're at, Dr. Davis-Wilson, like I think we're at the point where the language probably needs to be in there and there needs to be some clarification so that we don't have people continuing to come to the board with supervision by people who are not licensed. And I think that becomes the bigger issue now.
Yeah, I do think it was kind of a placeholder to help some people kind of get grandfathered and grandmothered in and provide some protection for the school systems. But I, for one, would be up for that going away and getting rid of that exemption, as I feel as if they're, you know, wherever they're practicing behavior analytics services, they should be licensed.
I would just chime in and agree wholeheartedly.
And this is Jessica. I completely agree with that as well.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and just for clarification for all stakeholders, there is still that Section B that would still protect a teacher if they're doing FBAs. It would still protect a speech pathologist who's coordinating services or who may be using prompting strategies or who may be using reinforcement strategies. Like there still would be the protection for those who are still in those services. So I just want to make sure that that's clear because I know that in other times, this particular thing has been kind of a point of contention for me for a long time because I interpret it as being, again, and certified. And again, there's so many people that are like, well, I work for the school and that counts as an exemption. But I think that B captures exactly what the concern was, is what happens when a teacher is helping develop an FBA or a special ed teacher is oftentimes developing an FBA, you know, from start to finish. And this would not preclude their ability to do that. They would still be able to do that.
So, Mr. Chair, thinking back to the conversation we just had recently in a CBA meeting over a complaint, when I read B, and so Dr. Wilson, this is something I think probably, you know, putting on your thinking cap and thinking about how we deal with this, if a special education teacher is also a BCBA, okay, and comes forward and said, you know, and comes forward and there's a complaint file that she's acting without a license. And she says, well, listen, I did this FBA and wrote this behavior intervention plan as a certified special education teacher. And then we, you know, we look at the emails, and at her signature line, it's, you know, Mrs. Wilson, MA, BCBA. You know, at that point, are we, is the public assuming, well, a person has the BCBA, they most likely then should be licensed. You know, what is, you know, it was Dr. Stenhoff, I think, who brought that up in one of our other cases, that, you know, perception is everything. You throw those letters up there, you should be very proud you became that. But are you operating as a behavior analyst in that particular setting now with that? Or are you still a certified teacher? Is it your highest certification that governs what you need to do? Or is it any certification you may hold? And so I think that would be our, that would be the wrinkle in this, in my opinion. Doesn't change my opinion that it needs to go. It's just knowing, you know, kind of some history around cases that have come forward. That is a potential pitfall for us.
Dr. Davey, I think we need to advance cautiously in that regard too. Behavior analysis is a way of thinking about things. And it's very difficult to say, you know, that I have this hat on or I have that hat on, especially if your training has been primary behavior analytic in a special ed training program. So that could be problematic. The other is that, as you were speaking, I thought about a therapy that is becoming more popular as things go along, and I'm referring to ACT. But, you know, if I'm a licensed counselor or a behavior analyst, a licensed counselor can act, you know, provide ACT, is my understanding, as that type of therapy, but as a behavior analyst, you cannot. But there's several, or there are BCBAs in the state that are both licensed counselors and are also BCBAs, and their signature indicates as such. So, and the way of the way that things are analyzed, there's crossover in between. So, as a committee and I think as the board, there's got to be some level of caution, I guess, and maybe some understanding that there. It's hard to say that there is not carryover. And I think that we need to be very cautious as a field, and especially as a committee, and even more importantly as a board, of that carryover and an accusation of what hat you're wearing. I'm thinking of a teacher sending out a FBA for a family to review, and they have the BCBA on there. So do they need to be cautious or have a couple of signatures where when they're sending out the teacher, BCBA is not on there? And then if they're acting as the BCBA for the school, you see it? So there's a large area of gray that that I'm cautious about. So that's another, again, just another statement. I don't know if anything can be fixed, but just a comment to be made.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I am aware of other professions who have statutes that address use of titles and actually specify how a title is to be presented by someone who is licensed under that particular chapter. It is generally that language specifies, you know, first the designated, you know, I am a, in this case, I'm looking at the PT statute, immediately following my name, the initials PT must follow. Any other certifications that I have achieved may follow, you know, in any fashion, any order at the discretion of the individual. I don't know that gets entirely at what you're discussing, but for purposes of informing the public, requiring a specific title, that's informative on some level.
Yeah. You know, as I reread B, I'm going to read it out loud. This article does not prevent a member of other recognized professions who is licensed, certified, or regulated under the laws of this state. So being certified as a behavior analyst, that's not under our law.
So let me, can I comment to that? Because I think I'm going to tie in kind of Dr. Davey, your points, and then Dr. Stenhoff. So first of all, the idea behind a little bit of the earlier conversation would be to discourage people who are BCBAs from not seeking licensure just because they don't need to, Because when that happens, now they're supervising and we're down this like this rabbit hole of the issues that we're having. But the people that we were concerned about, it was the, and included those that are like a teacher that maybe isn't a BCBA, that by their scope of practice would potentially be using strategies that could be foreseen as practicing without a license. So I think the first question is do we want or foresee a need for BCBAs, certified BCBAs who are also teachers, to not be licensed? Because I think we're kind of mixing the two issues. And if we do, then do we recraft that language? Because there is no Department of Education certification for them, other than if you're also a teacher or a school psychologist, because those are the only two, and I think they might have a certification for parapros, but those are the only Department of Education things. So if we scratch that, we're essentially saying, hey, if you're a behavior analyst practicing in the capacity of being a behavior analyst, we have a title act that says if you call yourself a behavior analyst, then you must be licensed. So that would require those teachers and what have you to become licensed, which would effectively address our issue of the supervisees coming forth and not being eligible for licensure because the teacher BCBA or what have you wasn't licensed. And I'm just giving the scenarios. I'm not giving my opinion. And then that B would still protect the special ed teacher who isn't, or the speech path or whoever, who isn't licensed or certified in behavior analysis. They are licensed or certified in a field where that crossover may happen. And to Dr. Stenhoff, your point, where we would be looking at is that scope of practice, which does become that gray area. And what we've done in complaints involving scope of practice in the past on the board, we haven't seen any as behavior analysts, but with psychologists, is, you know, we look to subject matter experts of what would qualify someone to count that as their scope of practice. So for example, there we had, we have situations where someone might be doing workman's comp evaluations, and maybe they're doing workman's comp evaluations on individuals that have PTSD. Then when we see that complaint, or a complaint involving that, then the board can look and say, what was their training? What was their expertise? Where did they have that? So that scope of practice language allows for us to gauge a little bit of that crossover, and then allowing them to practice under. So again, I'm a counselor, or I'm a psychologist, or I'm a speech path, and I'm using behavior analytic strategies because that's within my training. Then I could use that. I just wouldn't call myself a behavior analyst. But for those cases, to Dr. Davies' point, where it's like, I'm a teacher, but I'm doing the FBA and I just happen to be a BCBA, so I'm going to slap that on there. That's problematic in a couple of ways, because that does, you know, one, I've seen the schools use that as a way to like tell families like, oh no, we have the qualified person and we are providing ABA to your child, even though they're not. And then I end up with that, you know, maybe that BCBA teacher is a former supervisee of mine, and they call me and they'll be like, hey, the school's kind of misrepresenting my credentials. So that's an issue too, where then the school's like, well, you have a BCBA, therefore. And so now they're being thrown out there as a BCBA to the public, and they're having to correct that from their employer. So I hear the concern of what happens if you're a teacher BCBA. Like, do you then just not, are you not, if you're not licensed, do you not use the term BCBA? And I would argue, yes, you wouldn't use that, because it would potentially violate the title act. And yes, I think that you should be very proud of yourself and that's a hard work and all of that. But why is it that you wouldn't want to be licensed would be kind of my question. And I don't have the answer, and I don't know that I have a solution to it. But the pitfall of it is, by them choosing to not be licensed, they're still misrepresenting themselves to supervisees and to families. And so, and that's happening even with the current language. That's happening even with that section being in place. So I hear the concerns and I totally understand them. I think we've got to decide which direction to take, because I don't think we can take both. I don't think we can keep the language as is and kind of protect teacher BCBAs that are opting to not be licensed and still address the issues that we're seeing of unlicensed practice and supervision.
To kind of go back to the original intent of how this language generated, I think, you know, there was no precedence. There really was no board at that time. We didn't know how people were going to handle complaints. And so now I think that precedence has been set that if you are a certified teacher and you're working in special education, that you can participate in the FBA process. And, you know, our board is not going to go after teachers who are not BCBAs and LBAs. You know, but that was just originally put in there, kind of like we were saying earlier, as a placeholder. The definite intention of that was not to allow, you know, teachers to become BCBAs and not further pursue their LBA and not be licensed. And so I think there's a difference between a certified teacher who's practicing within the arena that we consider behavior analysis, but has a teaching license, it's within their scope and training within school. They are beholden to the, you know, Department of Education and their education license. And so, you know, I do think that this language may be confusing other people, you know, and to go to the fact of the and versus the or. That's why the and was put in there, is that we're talking about, you know, certified teachers. But we also now have the precedence of our board that our board is not going to go after special education teachers and say, you can't do an FBA or you can't, you know, partake or set up data collection systems around these specific issues. And so, you know, I would advocate that we not have language in there that may be confusing people to have a BCBA, have a teaching degree, and then also not pursue an LBA.
Hi, this is Kyle Leininger. I just had another point related to conversations about who this section applies to as far as teachers are concerned and the public charter private delineation. It is the case that there are teachers that work in the private in private schools that are also certified teachers with ADE, and so I think that may require additional clarification as well, because this might be an exemption for certified teachers even though they don't work in a public school or charter school setting.
And Mr. Leininger, we would be taking out that line item entirely as our current proposal is to even just to remove that and then protect the teachers under B, which says that the article does not prevent a member of a other recognized profession who is licensed or certified or regulated under the laws of the state from rendering services within their scope of practice. So that would allow, regardless of their place of employment, that would allow a teacher, if it's within their scope of practice, to conduct those services.
Thank you.
This is Carrie Baranek. It sounds like I'm preaching to the choir, but I would agree that number one, those exemptions for certified individuals gets us into a lot of trouble. I've seen situations personally where you know, emergency certified teachers with very little training or, you know, scope are writing what they're calling FBAs and providing direction to non-certified, non-professional staff who are implementing behavior analytic strategies. So very concerning to me. And if the mission is public protection, I feel that exemption is putting us at a big risk as a profession. If that exemption remains, I would propose or recommend a definition of common school, because I do see that being very confusing for folks at times, but it sounds like it will be removed. And I agree too with some of the comments around why an individual would, you know, become certified and then not seek out an LBA. So I know it's, it sort of sounds counterintuitive to say you either don't have to have any of it or you have to have all of it. But I think that does allow this board to enforce the things that it needs to enforce for someone who is practicing as a BCBA. And if they have BCBA in their title, and to Dr. Stenhoff's point, it's a way of thinking. So even if you don't have it in your signature line, if you're acting and conducting yourself as a behavior analyst, then this board should be able to have some governance over those actions. And so I agree, and I feel like it would be important to require licensure at that point. But I do want to say that I think this would put a lot of people in a tight spot. So I would recommend some sort of grandfather or grandmother clause to allow this to transition in a timeline that would allow schools in particular to prepare for this, because this will require a big shift in their thinking and their training and in their, you know, sort of hiring practices. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, with Ms. Berenick, that might be, and this is one of the things that we talked about, this particular issue we had on a previous agenda item, and we started talking about it. And then because what has happened over the year is our meetings have gotten kind of more and more hefty in content. And so what has happened is all the stakeholders call into the meeting, and then the meeting goes on and on and on. And unfortunately, you guys, the stakeholders, have had to jump off. So this is exactly why we scheduled this meeting today, was to allow for these conversations. And then, you know, one of the things that we talked about is, if we know that this is going to be a potential change, working with the professional association and perhaps, you know, their program committee to start educating as soon as possible. Because there probably won't be something written into the statute of like effective this date or whatever, but the statute process. So once the bill is drafted, which won't, Ms. Pecknon can correct me if I'm wrong, but we've already missed 2021. Like, this will be 2022 before it's even drafted. It, you know, the earliest it's going to go into effect would be what, July 1st of 2022, January 1st of 2023. But plenty of time to allow for stakeholders to reach out to, you know, potential individuals that this may affect, and start having those conversations once the bill is drafted. I agree with you. I think schools are going to need to understand that it's going to be a requirement if they're going to use that employee in the capacity of a behavior analyst. And I'm aware of a few behavior analysts that have kind of been like, I don't want to get licensed. And so I'm not going to get licensed. And those people are also going to need to be aware of this change. Absolutely.
So I think there's going to be some community education. I also, you know, Dr. Davey pointed out, you have BCBAs who are noting that they're BCBAs but are unlicensed. And I think the title component, I think there needs to be an increased awareness of that, that if you're going to use that BCBA as a school teacher, there needs to be an LBA component to that as well. And then if they're not going to highlight their BCBA, then remove it. Don't use the BCBA if they're not acting in that capacity. I think it's in, like, you know, the state organizations and, you know, training programs, teacher prep programs, you know, obviously needs to be increased awareness and distributed to the students as well. Okay. Any more on that piece? And Dr. Davey, you began to discuss issues you have with number two.
No, I would just ask that, you know, even as this meeting progresses, you know, that we just orientate Ms. Galvin to that suggestion for number one, just to make sure she does not, you know, she can come back to us at any time and give us feedback, but I want to make sure she's a part of that discussion that I was going to step out. Or maybe she's back.
And I am back, and I can discuss that with Heidi, because I missed your concern or question.
Okay. We just want to strike
entire exemption. So nothing small.
And that's 0.08A1?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, okay. So yes, Ms. Galvin, that's great. Yeah, Dr. Stanoff, number two, it never, I just always kind of scratched my head about what this meant for our field, right? An employee of a government.
Well, I'm not alone, Dr. Davey. I'm
good so you're an employee of a government agency. So let's just say you're Ms. Pakenon, who uses the word assistant or associate in her title. Like, why is she, you know, I just don't understand. It's supervised by a doctorate level position employee. So to me, I don't understand why you would be exempt. If you're engaged in the practice being, you know, of behavior analysis, why does it matter that you're a work for the government? So I don't know the history of that, and I can't recall it, unless it's just a direct carryover from.
Dr. Wilson, this is Jean Galvin. I don't know if this is my recollection is correct, but did it have to do with billing and DDD when you use associates or assistants?
I don't think.
It does not, because we've actually addressed that with DDD under 3 now. So we now define in access and DDD, the behavior analysis trainee. So that's actually covered under 3 now. It could have been historically a little bit, but this to me sounds like a carryover, because we don't have, this sounds almost like a partnership with the government to train psychologists, train psychologists or research assistants up or something. And maybe a designation from like the postdoc folks to like folks that may be working for the government. But I don't know that this translates to behavior analysis, but to Ms. Galvin, to your point, I think the stakeholders and all of us agree that the nature of 3 about the behavior analysis trainee was really what captured what we were doing with DDD and Access. And so Access wrote very similar language to align with number 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when I look at it, like I'm trying to think to myself, right? So let's just say there's a doctor, let's just say Dr. Stenhoff goes to work at Access. And then this would allow him to have someone underneath him who was an assistant behavior analyst, and they would not have to be licensed. And that to me, one, would put Dr. Stenhoff in a precarious position for ethical considerations, not only by the BACB, but by this committee. And so I just don't find its pertinence to our situation. So I would move that be removed, unless there's some other overriding reason from the board or from the state that needs to remain.
I would agree. I don't think we have subdoctorate positions. And I think that even if somebody was working toward, so there is a new BCBAD path that allows for an individual to work under another BCBAD for 1500 hours. So for example, I'm not a BCBAD, but if I wanted that designation, I could work under like Dr. Stenhoff or Dr. Davey. Well, I couldn't, because that'd be conflict of interest, but for the nature of example, I could work under them in a supervisory position to obtain my BCBAD. But I don't know that even translates here, because at that point I wouldn't be an assistant or an associate. I would still be independently licensed, because the BCBAD isn't a designation that the state differentiates. So I other than that new designation, like, we don't really have a subdoctorate position.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I say let's keep plugging away then.
Okay. Any other comments on the exemptions from licensure statute?
I have one more for you, Dr. Stenhoff. As far as the number five, so a person in the employ of Arizona State University, Northern Arizona, or U of A, I think that this is probably fine. And I can think of some like the ASU online program is overseen by somebody that's not a licensed behavior analyst, and that's fine. Do we run into any issues? I know in the beginning, Dr. Haas was, you know, originally exempt from this, but then he realized with the practicum component that he probably needed to be licensed. Is there anything in language of this, or is this just something that you guys are fine just navigating?
Yeah, I think it's fine. At the point that there is supervision being provided by us, if we were to do that, then obviously we would have to be licensed. But for the practicum class, even, I'm not sure, because there's no direct oversight in that class of is the supervisor's responsibility. So there's no direct oversight of the faculty to the students for their practicum experiences. I think we're fine on that at this point. So
my next question would be, you know, we kind of have this limited to just the universities in this state. Mm-hmm. Given the number of online programs and some of the issues that we're running into with the online programs, is this language that we want to explore as far as helping bridge, because I think it's that same argument, right? Like in some of these cases, the programs are overseeing practicum programs, but their hours are being done elsewhere. But they might be meeting with the students weekly or what have you. And we've had situations where we've sat back and been a little bit confused about the practicum oversight by the university. And if that oversight was happening at an Arizona university, then we would have had an answer in our exemptions here. But now their hours still wouldn't be able to count towards supervision, but we wouldn't have this question of, are they also practicing without a license in their role? Is that something, and I don't know if this is an area to address it, but if, for example, you know, we had FIT and Chicago School join us for a pretty robust conversation, could that be resolved by expanding this a little bit, knowing that so many of the behavior analysis programs are online, they're not in person? Could we expand this a little bit and at least cover, again, those students wouldn't be able to count their supervision towards licensure, but could we at least cover that kind of uneasiness of, is, you know, Dr. Szabo, or is, you know, are they practicing without a license?
Yeah. Well, could we remove, I know we have the universities listed here. I just really quick too, this is just, anyway, I'll come back to it. So could we remove the word regionally and take care of that? And then, or maybe just say an accredited. So in the employee of an accredited university, and leave it at that.
And then remove in this state?
In this state. And then, yeah. And then also, do we need the listed universities there? Because if it's saying a person, an employee of another or of an accredited university, if the services are part of, et cetera. Because if we remove in the state, then that eliminates the need to list the universities in the state, if that's the direction we want to go with that. Because when we did have that conversation with the faculty from universities outside of the state, we found that they were operating within the bounds of it. And it didn't matter whether they were in their state or not. It was just they were operating within the requirements of the statute.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. I think that if we just said, because I think what captures the more important part is that it's the faculty's duties as part of a salaried position.
Right.
And it's a part of it. So we wouldn't be looking at like adjunct faculty that are contracted to help with supervision or those sorts of funky things. You know,
right.
I know that that there are several schools that bring on adjunct faculty for the purpose of supervision or practicum oversight, like those ones would absolutely need to be licensed because they're supervising. Right. But when we talk to your point, when we talk to those universities and we just said, tell us what it is that you do, what they do was captured, but we still had, prior to meeting with them, this kind of uneasy of, is it captured?
Right. Yeah.
And I think it's because they're in that salary, full-time, you know, position that makes that big difference. I would be okay with saying a person that is employed by an accredited university, if the services fall under the faculty duties person's salaried position and is participating in a graduate program. Like, I think that would suffice. It would at least solve half of the problem that came of the university practicum issue.
Yeah, and I think a part of the, if I'm remembering correctly, part of it too was whether, as you mentioned, whether they were counting those hours towards their licensure. And I think that was also, may have been even the red flag that kind of set the conversation in motion too. So, or that conversation in motion.
So can I just, I don't want to be the stick in the mud here, but I do have, like, I understand Arizona State, Northern Arizona University, like, we have ties to those universities. Those are local universities that we know the professors that are engaged in that, those activities. If we extend this out and we are essentially green lighting other professors who may not be in this state to provide supervised activities, we're not going to allow the supervised activities?
No, they would still, supervised activities would still require licensure.
Okay, so I think, you know, when I read this, to me, supervision could be part of a faculty's duties.
Yeah, I agree. I think the same thing. We need to spell that out more clearly.
It would have to be parsed out that supervision is still, supervision in the state still requires licensure. That's very uneasy about advocating that particular point.
I agree with that. And that was why I asked the first question, because I think whether we're talking about Arizona universities or non-Arizona universities, how is this section interpreted? Because I agree with that exact same thing. And to the point of Dr. Haas, like, took the job and was going to proceed without licensure. And then we were like, well, wait a second, if any of those hours, or it's perceived as those hours or what have you. And I agree. I don't think it's clear whether we keep Arizona in here or not. I think it needs to be very clear. But it was just funky, like, when we talked to the individuals from the Chicago School and FIT, it was like a linguistics thing. When they really told us what they were doing, they weren't supervising. They were coordinating practicum stuff. They were in correspondence with their practicum people. They maybe were grading an assignment that was done at a practicum site. There wasn't like supervision. And then those individuals were subsequently also being supervised by a licensed behavior analyst. So I think it was just a really like funky thing, because in the beginning, I worried that, well, maybe they're practicing without a license, but I agree with you. I don't think whether we keep it as Arizona universities or not, that it's clear that supervision would not be a part of that.
So maybe it needs to read if the services are part of the faculty duties, with the exception of direct clinical supervision or something. And I think the term clinical supervision, again, supervision is an HR function, as we've all learned in this field. Supervision of practicum students could simply be coordinating their efforts to get to the sites, but clinical supervision towards hours is a much different beast. And so somehow, you know, there needs to be the language in there that still requires licensure, that they can be exempt from licensure as they're training and training our young behavior analysts. But if they're going to provide supervision that you know, over clients who are being taught or trained by their students, then they've got to have that licensure piece. So maybe Ms. Pacanon and Jean can come back to us with some language that captures that spirit.
And I think to your point, Dr. Davey, we need to add something even more encompassing, clinical supervision, because again, I think that might be misinterpreted, because you can provide, you know, some clinical insight, but it may not be what we're talking about here. So I agree. I think the language needs to be worked through, and it probably needs to be even more prescriptive than just clinical.
Yeah, I agree.
And I wonder, Ms. Pakanon, if you could even with Ms. Folks crosswalk the language from the rules and statute that talk about supervised experience. Because I agree, because if we also just limit it to direct clinical, we're at a 60-40 now, where only 40 is direct clinical. And some could articulate that the other 60 is indirect. And while yes, clinical, is it direct? So I think that we want to make sure that language matches the intent of, if you're supervising them, like for the purpose of licensure or for the purpose of practice, that would require a license. But if you're just serving in the role of faculty of a university, that doesn't necessarily imply that you would be practicing without a license if you're providing some of these training and other services to students.
Yeah. Good. It's exciting.
Are any other items on this statute?
Yes.
Can we move on?
On this by five, or can we move to six?
I think we're good with five.
So six, you know,
yeah.
I just don't know if like the titles have changed. Like, do we still use ABA technician? Yeah, I don't know that I think behavior technician captures RBT, tutor, you know. It's all semantics. The major point is you can't claim to be a professional behavior analyst. Are we still good with those particular titles? Does the BACB dictate any titles for like RBTs in training or anything like that? I don't think they do.
No.
And
we can't, and because we don't require RBTs in the state, and because that's a capacity issue that Access has already identified as potentially being problematic, which behavior technician captures. I wonder, can we put like an et cetera there? Because the bigger piece of this is that we don't want them calling themselves a behavior analyst, but they have to still be under the direction of a licensed behavior analyst. So the first sentence is saying, you can't call yourself behavior analyst, you're not credentialed, but you're practicing under the license of. But I feel like there's so many different titles. We have behavior analysis. Well, we've covered behavior analysis trainee, but we have, you know, clinical interventionists. We have, I mean, everybody uses so many different titles that I wonder if it.
Well, I think we have that captured. I don't think you can put et cetera, such as right before ABA technician.
Yeah.
It was really there. And I think our legal team would say the et cetera is problematic. I mean, the such as is probably the way around that, which in essence means et cetera. Here comes Ms. Galvin.
Is the phrasing such as and for example analogous?
You could say including but not limited to.
Okay.
I like that.
All right, any other notes for this statute? We've talked fairly well through B.
Would this, this is Dr. Rates, I have a strange question. Would this be a space to our previous conversations of someone who has perhaps become credentialed, is not yet licensed? So would they fall under this as well, to sort of our previous conversation about not suggesting that you are in that capacity until you become an LBA?
So Dr. Reyes, I think, yeah, if there's any indication, so let's just say I sat for the exam and I passed and I'm now a BCBA, I think it would be best not to list my BCBA in my credentials because it is misleading and it is recognized by the community that you're a behavior analyst.
So would we suggest a language here that just says the non-credentialed or licensed?
This is exceptions to licensure. So this section is saying these people here are exempt from licensure. And so the way that I have my students capture is still under number 3. Yes, you passed your exam, but that's not sufficient enough in Arizona. You do have to be licensed. So you must remain a behavior analysis trainee until you're an LBA. And that's how I like address it on a personal practice, but I don't know that we could put it here. I think maybe either perhaps in rule or another section, but this section is talking about who isn't required to be licensed.
I would agree with that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a good reminder. Thank you.
It's good stuff.
I think it's a great suggestion to have somewhere, whether it's in guidance, whether it's something that, we have another agenda item coming up to talk about these common issues that we're running into to see if perhaps the stakeholders can help with community education. I think that's absolutely a great point of discussion.
Okay, we are at 2 hours into the meeting. Or just pass. So, does anybody need to take a break?
We've only gotten through 10% of our documents.
Yes, and I guess I should ask, is there any terminal endpoints for this meeting for everybody, or do we just end the meeting? I don't know the rules on that one, but I know we're scheduled till 11:30 if I remember correctly.
I think we're scheduled till 12:30.
Till 12:30, okay.
Yeah, you know, just historically in the past, just as a heads up, like these have been kind of hefty kind of meetings and conversations, and I think that it's fine to just reschedule at another time. However, one suggestion that I might make is that, again, these are topics that we've kind of postponed not for any other purpose except we want stakeholder engagement. And so I don't know if we want to before we end, make sure that the stakeholders don't have anything that they like have been just pins and needles waiting for us to just get to and we just haven't yet, or if they're okay with us continuing to have these meetings, including them in that engagement and moving forward. But I think we're open to ending at the discretion of you as the chair to when you'd like to end.
Okay. So if we get to such time that we find that we haven't finished the agenda items, I will throw that out or request additional comments for the stakeholders. And is everybody fine to continue on, or do we need to take a break?
Probably a 5-minute break.
Okay, so we'll reconvene in 5 minutes.
Cool, thanks.
Okay. All right. I think we're ready to get started. Okay. So any more comments on that statute? Okay. Ms. Pacanon, we can move on to the next one then.
Yes, Dr. Stenhoff, I will have a comment on this statute. And then in general, I believe that we're going to pick up some velocity here, at least where the next 5 or so statutes are concerned, because a lot of this language either emulates language in Title 41, which is a portion of which is the Administrative Procedures Act, and then also, again, language that emulates that in the psychology statutes. So my comment, I need to log into my other screen. The bill that I mentioned earlier, so recently filed Senate Bill 1253, does propose a change to this statute at subsection D. Language is inserted at the beginning of subsection D, which reads, except as provided in subsection E of this section, the CBA, the CBA shall review all complaints. Essentially what this means is that this language was found by the board's legislative and rules committee to be confusing in that it seemed to suggest that certain complaints where the public health, welfare, and safety was at imminent risk or could potentially be at imminent risk, those that information or the complaints of that nature needed to first go to the CBA before to the board for possible summary suspension. So the language that I just described clarifies that if board staff and legal counsel feel that a complaint of that nature is received, we can bypass the CBA and go directly to the board for that emergency action. So in essence, you know, address the issue more effectively and promptly than if it had to go through a two-stage process. So the that language that I'm describing is also proposed in the psychologist statutes. So I hope that made sense.
Yeah, Ms. Kakanon, a follow-up question to that. Is there a criteria that determination would be made?
That's a great question for Ms. Galvin, I think.
Okay.
And typically that would be conduct that would jeopardize the public's health, safety, or welfare. And these kinds of cases, staff would discuss the pending complaint or information with me. If it involves a behavior analyst, the chair of the committee, and then the chair of the board.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Packer, did you have any others for that statute? Okay.
No, Mr. Chair, only that revision.
Okay. And committee members, any items in there that you'd like to address?
I have a general question for Ms. Galvin, I think. Ms. Galvin, are you there?
I am.
At what point, you know, as you look at how the psychologists have progressed over the years, and you think about the current makeup of our CBA calls that are combining, you know, upwards of 10, you know, between 8 to 12 applications every single meeting, plus this year we've had multiple complaints. We have ongoing complaints right now. At what point do we look to consider a complaint committee, or maybe that's the existing CBA, or do we look at an application review committee to help us break some of this stuff up and to move forward in a timely fashion? Is there a certain tipping point where that needs to happen? Is that something that would happen in statute? Is that something that requires a bill? What are your thoughts on that? Are we not to that point? Am I just feeling overwhelmed and need to get over myself?
See, the way the statute is written is that those functions would be performed by this committee. If you wanted to look at forming like a subcommittee to review applications and then make a recommendation to you all to make a recommendation then, you know, to the board, a subcommittee is something that you could look at. There's no tipping point in statute that would inform you as to when that subcommittee should be formed and what tasks they should be assigned and how it could assist this committee in performing its function. Legally, although it's not spelled out in statute, but committees have the authority to establish a subcommittee. When that happens and under what circumstances, I think would be up to you know, this committee in consultation maybe with the board chair.
I just wonder at what point it makes sense to bifurcate complaints from applications for timeliness.
I don't know how other committee members feel.
Ms. Galvin, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Galvin, Dr. Davey, I wonder, because I've also kind of tried to put it in. I think the harder issue is that we don't know from one meeting to the next whether it's an hour meeting or a 7-hour meeting. And so what ends up happening is we don't plan accordingly. Even if we say like 4 hours and then it's only an hour, it's like, oh, well, I could have scheduled this meeting that I canceled, or what have you. And so I agree. I think that we could probably work with board staff on how to allocate that. My concern with a subcommittee for this particular committee is with the way that the psychology board committees work, there's multiple, you know, we have what, 11 members to kind of pull from. We're like this committee, even if we like separated it into kind of smaller, because I think that we would run into issues if we relied on one statutorily, we would need to change the statute to increase the CBA beyond the 5 members, I would imagine. But then we would need the bodies of people who are willing to represent in that role. And I think that that's something that could be problematic, is getting members who above the 5 that we already have to want to do another 5-year commitment. So if we did a subcommittee, Jean, would that would have to still be by board and or CBA members though, right? So it could be that we do a subcommittee and maybe Don and I are doing complaints and Brian and Paige and Tisha are doing applications or whatever. And I think that would be difficult. I almost think we need to.
Can I clarify before Ms. Galvin speaks, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair and Dr. Wilson? I think what I'm suggesting is if there was a group of 2 that were going like on a rotating basis doing applications, I don't believe we can advocate the complaint. I think that needs to stay the CBA issue, and that's where that should be adjudicated. That matter should be adjudicated initially. But I do think like the application piece, if there was a team of 2 on a rotating basis from month to month, quarter to quarter, that might be a little bit easier to churn through. And I don't know, and I think your question to Jean is correct. Like, what is that number? It seems to me on the psychologist side that the application committee, you know, is pretty small, and it's not, you know, it's not 5 people. so I don't know what the rules are on those numbers, but I just wanted to clarify my thoughts a little bit on that.
So the board has a 2-member application review committee that makes recommendations to the board on applications. Are you suggesting or thinking that there would be like a 2-member application review committee to review behavior analyst applications and then make that recommendation straight to the board or through the committee?
Probably through the committee. I mean, I think that when the committee convenes in the whole, it would be, you know, here are the ones that we're moving, we'd like to move forward. You know, obviously we have the ability to pull someone off of the consent agenda like that. But yeah, I would think that would kind of go from subcommittee to committee to board.
I don't know if that would really reduce your workload or the workload of the committee.
Because we would still be obligated to review them all. So it would have to be most like the subcommittee then would then push them through all the way to the full board. And that's how.
And I don't think that's contemplated by the statute.
So we would need that to be contemplated by the statute, that we would essentially create an application committee.
Right. I think what, like Dr. Davis Wilson said, the hard part is not being able to gauge how long these meetings are going to last. Because in addition to the applications, you don't have that many complaints, but you know, that's ticking up slightly. But then there are these substantive issues that necessarily have to be addressed by the committee eventually. So that's, I think, is what you know, adds more time to your meetings. And that it's just, if there's a way to that we could, you know, gauge that, limit the number of items per meeting, but you're already meeting monthly, mm-hmm. and have fairly significant agendas each time. I'm trying to think if, and everybody, staff may have thoughts too, whether a subcommittee would
really reduce the work of the committee, and it would certainly, you know, increase the work of the staff. And I just don't know what we could accomplish, but you know, you can also just, you know, try it out and see if it does work.
Ms. Galvin, just so I understand, the psychology has a committee, a two-person committee that reviews applications and submits or recommends to the full board. Is that in statute, that committee? And it's not technically a subcommittee, it's a committee, correct?
It is a committee, and I do not believe the application review committee is in statute, but the their complaint screening committee is in statute. Am I correct, Heidi?
Ms. Galvin, if I may, yes, the complaint screening is spelled out in statute, but then there's a general committee statute that talks about the board's ability to utilize committees in that capacity.
Right.
But I think so. And then there's a committee statute for behavior analysis. And so I think that's where it gets kind of tricky is if the committee statute on behavior analysis says that this behavior analytic committee needs to see all behavior analytic issues before it moves forward to the full board, regardless of how we break that up, the committee would still have to see it. So whether it's a subcommittee, then referring to the committee, and then we're kind of duplicating work there, or how we schedule, like the difference is that in the psychologist statute, there's multiple committees kind of already alluded to. The complaint screening's listed in there, but then there's the authority of the board to create additional committees.
Yes. Without specifically mentioning the application review committee.
And the problem with our committee would be that we could look to the board and say, look, we're full and we're heavy and we need some help on whatever, but it would still have to go through the CBA. So even if we were to say, maybe, you know, Ms. Shreves has some time to then help and they wanted to create a subcommittee through that committee language to help. We still have a statute that says all of these things still have to come through the CBA. So we would still have to, even if we recruited some additional help, the bulk of it would be the five of us are still responsible for, per statute, for all pretty much overseeing all things behavior analytic. And that brings me, and we can talk about it again when we get there, but 32-2091.15 is the other one that I brought up as a concern earlier this year for this exact reason, is that I think we need to start to, I think that bill was proposed to get representation from behavior analysts. And I think it was a great bill and it formed this committee and I think it did great. But I think now that we've had, you know, three, almost 4 years now of experiencing it, I think we might want to visit the language of that, which is the language that comprises this committee. And that is some, and I think that's where this conversation could be held, is that language right there. Cause I think that's what pigeonholes us to the five of us doing this. And the reality of it is to Dr. Davies' point, now I call myself semi-retired. I stay at home with the baby all day. But to Dr. Davies' point, in addition to the lengthy CBA meetings, we're also having lengthy board meetings. So you can pretty much guarantee that, you know, we've got at least two Fridays a month that are completely taken up in our schedules, which again, we signed up for and that's fine. But I think that might be some of the kind of burnout type concerns that I think longevity wise is why we should review the committee makeup and see under that statute how we could kind of forecast given the amount of information that we have. And I don't know, because I was having the same thoughts as Dr. Davey, I don't know if board staff, if it would be helpful in the past, if we've had really like, if we know we've had like specific agenda items that we know are just going to take a meeting of their own or whatever, if when we have those super busy months, would it be helpful to allocate two meetings? I don't know. But that could be an option too. And then that kind of just splits it up, gives everybody some time to split it up in their schedule. I don't know. But 32-2091.15, so 15, that's where we would look then at our committee makeup and all of that stuff.
and Dr. Davis Wilson and Dr. Davey, the concern I have too is let's say there's two additional meetings and then there's two additional board meetings. And the burnout point that you made, Dr. Davis Wilson, is a huge concern. And, you know, we've had, as of recent, some pretty significant or pretty lengthy meetings it's important, but your time, both yours and Dr. Davies' time, is being greatly absorbed by the board as well. And so I guess with that, I mean, I think there'd be a somewhat of a reduction in workload if we could have, like the psychology side has, two people reviewing and recommending to the board, but I'm not sure if we can, if the language allows at this point to do that, correct?
I mean, it would allow it. It would just still require that it goes through the committee onto the board if you established a subcommittee.
So it doesn't really reduce any effort. It increases workload for two people in addition to the CBA meeting to review it.
Right. And if you rotate those two members, you don't have a big pool. It's not like you're going to get, you know, 6 months off because you have so many other members that can sit on this subcommittee.
Well, we could discuss it further, I think, when we get to point 15. But any comments on this?
No, I just think it's just something we got to think about and acting into the reality of the situation we're in. Like, we've gone from being, you know, sub-100 licensees to now a lot. And I think that's going to stop anytime soon. And with that comes just additional workload from staff and from members. And if there's a smarter way to work through that, and if the psychologist can provide us some insight to what that might look like, that would be acceptable to me. So thank you for indulging my discussion.
Well, I just, as you were talking, Dr. Davey, one other point is a consideration of the board staff as well. And the meeting set up and the arrangement and getting things filed and putting documentation together is also how can that be handled too, without increasing the workload there perhaps. So I think that any decision we have, obviously board staff, I'd appreciate your feedback on what the ramifications towards you would be as well. So, okay, if there's nothing
Mr.
more
Chairman.
On that,
May, yes. Can I make a comment or have a question, or would you like me to save it?
Oh, no, go for it.
Okay. I certainly appreciate this discussion as it applies to, you know, getting applications for licensure through more quickly as someone who has a large staff and they send applications to all frequently. I know one of the barriers and challenges for you all has been when someone reviewing the application needs to abstain due to a conflict of interest. And that I have noticed has been one of the major reasons for a delay in licensure. So I guess my question or just maybe a comment would be, considering how you would rotate those individuals so that at every review period, there is not the need to delay that application further because you have one or both committee members who have a conflict of interest.
That's a great point. I think in part that's been remediated by the addition of Ms. Denton to the committee as well. So I think the likelihood of not having a quorum to vote on that has been reduced somewhat with the addition. So,
and the reality of that, Carrie, is that it would still go through the screening, the application screening committee. Let's just say there was not enough there. It still has to go to the CBA. And even if the CBA can't process, it still has to go to the full board. So the reality is, even when the committee can't work through it, it can't be fully reviewed and approved until it gets to the psychology board anyway. So when we have those incidences where we have to take it off and do it as a separate agenda item, it really is not a delay of any sort for those staff. Because the reality is, even if they were part of the consent agreement that was, or consent agenda that was put
forward by the CBA to the board, it still wouldn't be acted upon.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and board staff, Ms. Galvin, I think we have more than one, because I don't think that Dr. Malat is currently in term per se. But just to just give some context, Ms. Brannick, we not only did we have some form issues at the committee level, but we were short board members for a while. And so even moving that to the full board meeting was problematic because we didn't have the governor. There was a delay in getting even board members appointed. But in 2020, we were able, in addition to adding Ms. Denton, we were able to fill three or four of the vacancies on the board as well. So hopefully that'll be something that'll help also move it along.
I appreciate that. And I certainly don't mean to come across as any sort of criticism, just a comment for consideration.
No, I appreciate it. Like we feel the pressure too, but I just wanted you to know kind of like temporarily how that went down. Like, cause it is hard for us. Like we'd much rather not be a separate item because it takes up the full board's time where that has to be presented and creates kind of a trickle down effect. And so, you know, I think adding the fifth member, getting that fifth member's position filled was critical. And your point is taken, okay.
Yeah, good point.
And Mr. Chair, can I chime in a little bit with maybe a corollary piece of information? Our proposed budget for fiscal 2022, that budget year would begin July 1. Our proposal or our request includes adding a part-time position to sort of share the workload across the application processing, the administrative process. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to look like yet, but by way of good news, the governor's Office of Strategic Planning and Budget approved of that request. So we just have the next hurdle, which is the legislature's approval. So that's something I'm closely tracking in the coming weeks, of course, but it may be that in a few months we'll be expanding our staff. And in doing so, I hope that we find some efficiencies to address some of the things that you're talking about.
Well, that's great news. And it's probably very good news for board staff as well. So, yeah. Okay. Yes.
Committee, you had asked for input from staff about using a subcommittee. Right now we have it's in the rule, I believe, that requires applications to be administratively complete 18 days before the next board meeting in order to be agendized on the committee's meeting agenda. So we have a time frame issue there. And it takes quite a lot of time to put all the applications together to make sure all the supervisors have their licenses in there. You know, it's very time consuming. And to do that for a subcommittee within the time frame of those 18 days, and then for it to get on the CBA's agenda for a consent agenda, and then to go to the board for a consent agenda would be very complex. Okay. I'm not sure how convenient that would be. Now, the thought of two CBA meetings a month, I don't even know if you want to commit to something like that. The complaint process is different than the application process. Jennifer doesn't have to bring the complaints to the very next board meeting like I do for the applications. And so the time frame is not as critical on the complaints in that regard. There's time frames, of course, that have to be met, but not in relation to that 18-day window that I have to get the applications to you and then onto the board agenda. So that's something to consider as you're pondering how you want to handle your workload. I just wanted to give that information.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That's good feedback. So. there's no other comment on the statute, let's move on to next.
Okay. 1-0.
Mizzy, any comments on this?
Longest
shoulder.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to the next statute. Okay. Any comments on injunction? Okay. Back it on. Let's move on.
I don't know if Jean has any issues with any of that.
I do not.
Okay. All right, Ms. Backman. Any comments? Okay, move on. Any comments here? Okay, move on. Comments here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may. So just to give a little bit of background, and I see that we still have Carrie on the phone with us, I believe. Yeah, so a little bit of background on this. Back in early 2017, I believe, a group of stakeholders, pushed to add this, to drop a bill that would add this to the behavior analyst statutes. And this was specifically the formation of our committee, which was great. I think that, so I asked around the same time that Dr. Davidson resigned, I asked for this agenda item to be addressed, or this particular item to be addressed at a statutory review level. Because I think in hindsight of, I think the development of this committee was great. And I think the intent of what was written all here is great. But I feel like now that we've had some experience of what this committee means, I would like to explore how we can kind of address some of the nuances that we've seen as being problematic. Originally, my first one that I saw as being problematic was the a committee member may not serve more than 2 full consecutive terms. Now, the spirit of why that was written in there was because there was kind of this idea or this potential fear that if there was somebody that was not kind of serving in the interests of protecting the public from a behavior analytic standpoint, we wouldn't want them to continue to, stay on the board or what have you. And also this idea of we would like for more and more individuals in the field to have opportunities to these types of positions. My concern, though, goes to quorum issues and kind of burnout issues. Should we not be able to? So keeping in mind, especially again, the two of us that sit on the board, I mean, there's months that between committee review stuff and the committee plus board review stuff and the board, it is like having another part-time job. And my concern is that so many of the practicing behavior analysts are so young that being able to take on this amount of responsibility may not be something that they can do. And even if they sign up for it, I think we put ourselves in positions of potential resignations again in the future. And I think that it's a little bit prescriptive in a way that may later on down the road shoot us in the foot should we not be able to get people interested in serving in this role, being that it's a volunteer role. I think that to the, all of Dr. Davies' points, like we're already starting to see that the five-member committee meeting once a month is a lot of work still. It's an unpaid position. Not that it's about money. It's, you know, there's a whole bunch of other purposes, but it's an unpaid position. It's a long-term commitment. Other, you know, most behavior analysts are also working full-time jobs elsewhere. And so I just wonder if, and we don't have to draw it out today, but I wonder if we need to spend some time kind of revamping what the Committee on Behavior Analysts should look like to all the points discussed earlier, including the stakeholders, because obviously the stakeholders drew it out this way for a reason. But I think now that we have hands-on experience, I think we need to kind of have a conversation about what the committee's role and responsibilities and all of those things should be.
Dr. Davis Wilson, I agree. It's yeah, I think it is too. It can be too prescriptive. Are you concerned with the duration of the years serving, or is it just that it's so clear that you can only serve two terms, for example? Or
I think that, and I believe the 5 years matches the psychology board. Mm-hmm. Term. And so I think that that part is fine. Mine is more of the consecutive. If you look at the psychology board, many of quite a few of the members, some especially the younger professionals, only serve one term. But quite a few of the members serve 2, 3, 4 terms. And so I just don't want to be too restrictive. I think the 5 years is consistent. I think the challenge that we're going to run into is the 5 years board appointment is going to conflict potentially with then the two consecutive years, because the board doesn't have a, you can only serve two full consecutive years. So my question is what trumps what? If it sounds like Brian's looking to do a few more terms, if he is wanting to do another three term, let's say he goes through his term and he does another one and he's at his second, he goes to do another one. Can he do that as a member of the board, being that the board allows it? Or is it that the committee says, well, you can only do two, and therefore you're, you know, that no longer is an option for you to serve a third term on the board? Because there's conflicting language there, because the board doesn't have a only two consecutive terms. So there's that piece. And then I worry that, and I can't forecast, but I'll use myself as an example. I am, again, staying at home with a child. I've done a lot in my career and I'm happy to be at home for, you know, the unforeseeable future. And so I have the time to commit to volunteer positions, but not everybody does. And that's my concern about having a two full consecutive term is, what happened? I mean, we have a board member right now that isn't even serving a term, but is still on the board because they haven't even been able to fill that person's position. So I just feel like that statement there, the intent of it was good. I just think that it's going to potentially in the future be problematic.
This is Jean. It's written as it may not serve more than two. So a member wouldn't have to serve more than two if someone wants to. Right. Yeah, end at 5 years, that's fine. Or circumstances require that they end at three, that's what happens as well. But it would allow someone to come back after sitting out for a term if they desired.
Is there,
it wouldn't allow for a third term consecutive.
Correct, but you could sit out 5 years and then come back.
Dr. Davis Wilson, would you recommend striking that last sentence? But I'll just say from my viewpoint, I think those people that are willing to serve and want to serve and continue doing what you suggested earlier, protecting the public, that they shouldn't be restricted to two full consecutive terms. That if they want to serve longer, then so be it.
My my concern to that degree is I would just hate that a statute is what dictates that over other circumstances. And I think, I mean, this is to what Dr. Davey said, especially for those that are also serving on the board, this is a lot of work. And I don't think it's going to slow down. I think these longer meetings and more complaints and more applications, like this is, I think we are going to be in a position of needing to figure out how do we accomplish what the intent of the Committee of Behavior Analysts is. How do we accomplish that with the workload that we're going to be given? I think that's going to continue to rise. And so I would just hate to be in a position where people are, where we have vacancies or the potential to have vacancies when there is somebody who's willing to serve in the position but can't because of a statutory restriction. Now, I want to give the intent and the caveat of that is that the stakeholders that wrote this out, and that's why I want the stakeholder input, they had reason and concern to do this. And so I think it's important to hear them out on their reason and concern and to see if now that it's been played out, because similar to what Ms. Reese said earlier today with the exemptions, they didn't know what the board was going to do with any of this. And so they went a little bit, you know, more overboard and kind of, you know, conservative with like, hey, we need to include this and add this and make sure that we've kept all of this. But now they're like, oh, that didn't pan out at all as we thought it might have. So I would just hate for that language to restrict it if that's all that's holding it up. I don't know. I don't know the amount of work that goes into this. I don't know anybody who would do a third consecutive term. I mean, who knows? It could just be a moot point. I don't know. I just feel funny about it.
This is Jean. I do know that Heidi and you may want to pipe in. I do know that probably within the last 4 or 5 years, there was legislation enacted to limit board members' terms on other boards, particularly like the medical board and the osteopathic board, where the governor, and this is just what I am recalling, was of the position that a member shouldn't serve, you know, just consecutive term after consecutive term. And that's where maybe this language came in to try to limit the term so you don't have someone on there for, you know, 20 years, which is kind of the opposite, Dr. Davis Wilson, of what you're saying is if somebody wants to be able to serve more than two terms, you know, you would think that you would want some method for them to do so. I would just suggest if there should be something either allowing someone to serve a number of terms or prohibiting it, just so it's clear how long someone is able to serve if you're thinking of changing the language. And I don't know, this has, while you're talking about the workload and whatever, and I don't know if this would resolve anything, this would have to go through statute. But, and I don't know if we have an issue of trying to get find people to serve, but what if there were two committees on behavior analysis that the applications and the complaints would be divided up? They would act and operate independently. Their recommendations would both go to the board, but then you essentially have half of the work. Maybe Committee A would meet for 3 months and then Committee B would meet for the next 3 months.
Or could we have additional language here to establish a maybe like a three person committee? Because I think finding 10 people may be a little bit more challenging. And then who are the two that? But if we had like a two person, if we extended the Committee on Behavior Analysts or added a two person, I don't know if we could. Application review committee, who to Brian's point, like their sole job would just be an application review. And then that can go to the full board. And because we have two CBA members already on the full board, there would still be representation from the CBA, but then the CBA would kind of be able to do everything else. So I don't know if that would involve saying, hey, we need a 7-person CBA with two of those people being specifically a part of this subcommittee. And they spend their time just doing application reviews that then just go to the full board. Like, could we craft something along that lines? I think that it's this interesting thing of we've got 5 members that, you know, we're doing a lot of work, but I don't know that we could add another 5 people, even it with rotating commitments, I don't know that there's enough people, and Ms. Pacanon can talk to it, but even, you know, there was quite a bit of work in even getting Ms. Denton, you know, on, and it was because there were no other applicants. We worked with, you know, the professional association to try to not recruit applicants, but to try to, you know, to disseminate this. And it wasn't like we had like 12 professionals say, hey, I want to do it. We had Ms. Denton, you know, which is great. Thank you, Ms. Denton. We appreciate it. But that's my concern is I don't want to do so much that we're still having committee and quorum issues. I don't know.
Yeah. The answer to one of your questions is yes, you could have a committee of 3.
Okay. That could just be like application review.
Or do it all.
Yeah. Oh yeah. My concern of, I think the complaints would be very difficult with the committee, but my concern with rotating would be like when those complaints go across, you know, different quarters or when an application go, like, I feel like that could in essence either create more work or create some conflict.
I think there's at least from my viewpoint, there's a lot of strength, I think, in the whole committee reviewing the complaints. If we reduce it down to 3, I have some concerns about that because there's so much, well, so much documentation. And, you know, I would contend that we can't attend to all of that individually, but I think as a whole we can. And I think that's the strength in having the whole committee reviewing those versus a smaller subcommittee. That would be my hesitation to reducing a committee down to 3-4 complaints. Now the review committee for the applications, I'm not as concerned about. I think they're especially as of late, they're very streamlined. It's very clear what we're looking for. But I think a complaint would be difficult, especially with it being high stakes as well. So that'd be a concern for me.
I see that Mr. Leininger's joined us and perhaps he's been able to hear some of the commentary. And again, we don't have to have an answer today, but I think that what this stands out to me with this statute is that, again, the work that was done, and I know Mr. Leininger was involved in the original work, the work that was done was great and the committee makeup made sense. And for the first 2 years, it worked perfect. The meetings were 2 hours and everything was smooth. But again, I think we're a field that's just going to continue to grow. And I mean, would the stakeholders be open to having discussion around changes to the committee makeup?
Hi, this is Kyle Leininger. From what I'm hearing, I think we'd be open to that, of course.
Thank you. Cause I definitely don't want to come in and seem like they worked hard to pass this bill and then we're just coming in and being like, hey, we don't like it. Cause I think at the time it was great. We're just seeing.
I mean, it is great. It's just, it's the reality that, I mean, I think Ms. Pacanon has the data. It's the reality of where we were upon initially being put under the psychologists to where we were even a year ago. Like, we have been licensing individuals at a pretty fast pace, and that requires a lot of staff time and a lot of committee time. So I don't think it's a good problem as far as I'm concerned. And so, yeah, we need some assistance on how to work through that.
Mr. Davey, or Dr. Davey, Mr. Chair, I would also add to, like, I like the makeup of the five committee members, not just from a paperwork point of view, but from a subject matter expertise point of view, from just a logistical, like, a, you know, being able to provide input, because I do feel like the kind of diversity and experience and opinions and perspective is extremely important to ensure that the proceed, you know, that procedurally we're doing our best to serve the public. You know, part of me in a moment was like, well, what if we had, you know, one behavior analyst that was responsible for being on the board, because that's a lot of work. But I even like I like the diversity and perspectives. I think when we start to limit to three or to only one person maybe being on the board and the others just serving in committee capacity, as much as that would help allocate some of the work, I really like the ability to show that we're representing the multifaceted perspective of behavior analysis. You know, we've got academic representation. We have, you know, representation from those working with different, you know, diagnoses outside of autism and what have you. So I think that the minimum makeup of the committee makes sense. And I don't know if anybody would be open to, you know, maybe adding members to the committee, making the committee a little bit bigger to then allocate some of that work. I don't know.
So is that something that is that a decision to be made at this time moving forward, or do we want to table that and have it as a discussion, a separate meeting?
You know,
I would just say maybe could, or Dr. Wilson, could board staff maybe even look at how other, like how the B, whatever it is, the behavioral health examiners, like what other options or mechanisms are out there in boards? And I know there's not a lot that have subcommittees that oversee other professions, but maybe there's just some precedent there of how that's dealt with.
I agree with that. I think if we have the ability to do a little bit of investigation as to what that looked like, and I would even invite, you know, if we could, just the investigation from like the stakeholders. I think for me, I think this is kind of a working target. And again, we can't, if I'm not mistaken, we can't do anything about dropping a bill this year anyway. So we have some time to maybe, you know, schedule again in March or April or something with the stakeholders, but to give the stakeholders time to even think about it too, of what could be some possible solutions around some of it. And let's just come back to the drawing board. Like, I don't think we have to have any set answers. Just think that coming to an agreement as a group, both us with the stakeholders that we're, you know, in a position of forecasting additional work. I think that's enough for today. And I think we can kind of table it and everybody just kind of sit on it and think about it and bring perspectives to the next meeting.
That's fair. So Dr. Davis-Wilson, at this point, would you like that last sentence in A striped, or do we want to save that for the greater conversation?
I think we could save it for the greater conversation because I definitely think as part of the investigative, you know, kind of process, I think it would be beneficial to make sure that we're, you know, we kind of, like I say, that is, you know, stands out different from psychologists, but what if during 2021, the psychologists identify that as something, or there's a different legislation that then kind of pushes them in that direction in language, then we wouldn't want to strike it, you know? So I think I'm fine just keeping it open as just that entire section, just kind of needing to just be thought about and kind of digested while we think about the huge workload increase that we've seen over the last year in behavior in the committee's work.
So board staff, would you make a note? I know we're not deciding, but when we get to the agenda items to talk about future topics, could we bring this up again and put it on as a future topic discussion?
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Okay, any more comments on this one or overall comments across all the statutes that we just reviewed?
Okay. This is Carrie Baranek. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I will say that as a representative of the Arizona Association for Behavior Analysis, this is something that we are aware of, that we do need to sort of educate our members and sort of rally the troops. So it is one of our 2021 strategic objectives to increase legislative engagement and influence by the policy. And Kyle can even speak to it if he wishes, but we've begun work on perhaps creating like an endorsement tool or training to individuals that indicate that they are interested in serving on this board. So we're aware of it, and we're definitely open to future conversations and talks about what would be the most helpful.
Thank you. Okay, so Ms. Galvin, do we need to make a motion for this, for the suggestion?
Now that you've concluded your review of the statutes, the motion would be to recommend to the board to seek legislative changes as discussed at the committee. And because this isn't, I would think you're going to send this to the board in like one package and kind of not piecemeal, but the changes you've discussed and agreed to essentially can be memorialized by staff and then and move that and make that a motion, but then it'll go all up in one package.
Okay, great. So do we have a motion to submit these recommendations to the full board?
I'm moved.
I'll second, but I also have a question for Ms. Galvin. Do you think that it would be beneficial, and perhaps not, but I think of like Ms. Shreves and some others, do you think it'd be beneficial for us for that section on the Committee of Behavior Analysts to perhaps open, you know, it up for some board feedback? I know that's a little bit out of order, but I wonder if they have some ideas that we could also present at the table. I don't know, but I know that, you know, Dr. Malott works with a lot of different committees and subcommittees, and I know APBA does a lot of work with different subcommittees. And I just wonder if the board, if there's board members that may have some feedback on this.
And that's certainly something that the committee can ask to be put on a board agenda, you know, through staff, just to kind of alert the board that these are some discussions and look for feedback at this point versus, you know, way down the line when you may reach some conclusions and the board you find out later is, you know, opposed to that or has some better ideas or worse ideas, whatever.
So with the motion, the current motion, do we change the motion to seeking feedback from the board?
No, I would leave the motion as is, vote on that, and then just give have a consensus that Drs. Davis and Davey would go to the board, discuss what issues we're having around the committee's functions and role and size, and that you're going to be exploring that, and could the board give some feedback, you know, at the front end of that?
Okay, so, and then, sorry, Dr.
No, go ahead.
Sorry, Michael.
No,
so,
go ahead.
Dr. Davey, are you agreed to have that added to your motion?
Absolutely.
Okay, and then the second?
Yep.
Okay, any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Nay? Okay. All right, so this will move forward to the recommendations forward to the board then. Okay, so agenda item 5, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations for revisions of the administrative rules that regulate the practice of behavior analysis in Arizona. Ms. Pakenham, would you mind putting those up on your screen?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I am wondering, I've got two documents here. I'm struggling to figure out sequentially how you might want to address this. So maybe you can give me some direction. So we have the existing rules that we can, you know, work through rule by rule. We also have a summary, and I'll just open this, a summary of possible rule changes. What this encompasses, oh wait, it says my screen share is pause, resume share. Okay. What this document represents are just some historical discussions that have been held, where I have just, you know, captured these ideas or these concepts to bring forward at the appropriate time, which seems to be now. So this, I can sort of go through this list, or we can just sort of work through the rules, and then I can say, oh, time out, we've got that on our list of possible changes. So how do you want to do this?
What, why don't we go through the rules, and then as applicable, bring up the conversations or the notes that you have? Does that, I mean, does that seem logical to you and other committee members?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pekkanen, I have a question though. Being that we are twofold, we've got a bill right now with some statutory language change, and then we have essentially we're proposing that we want to do another bill. Other than glancing to make sure that there aren't any rules that need immediate change, wouldn't we be doing the rules after the statutes anyway? So I'm just trying to figure out if it makes sense going through all the rules or just glancing and making sure that there's nothing like glaring that needs changed this year because it's impacting public protection or what have you. And then I like the idea of looking at the running list too, because I think that that's kind of like the, we'll get to that when the rule change, but we can't, by the time, here's my concern. Even if we found something that needed changed today, by the time we got through the rule writing process, we would already be sitting with legislation proposed, and potentially two sets of legislation proposed to see how this bill that just went through goes. And then we would have to do rule writing after that anyway. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if we just can save some time, being that we can't really do anything about the rules right now anyway.
Mr. Chair, I think Dr. Davis-Wilson, you do make a compelling argument that this exercise may be a little premature. I mean, what we would end up undoubtedly doing is we could do this exercise right now, and we would find some things that, yes, we see that they're worthy of revision. But as you point out, we may want to hold that package until we have even more work to do as a result of new legislation. And so doesn't it make sense to roll it all into one big package instead of, you know, piecing it out across two?
And Ms. Pekkanen, correct me if I'm wrong, but the governor still requires us to go through the process to even request rule writing ability. And that's easier done if we say we need to write rules because these statutes were passed. And so we need to do it versus like, we kind of want to change these rules. And so I think that the amount of work that would need to go into doing anything with the rules right now and with COVID and executive orders, I just don't know that we have anything substantial enough to warrant that work right now, other than to keep in mind as we're doing the legislative work that there are corresponding rules that go with it. And then a couple of things like the CEU definitions changed by the BACB, so we may want to visit that in rule. But procedurally, I don't know that we would be able to get any rule work done until statute's done anyway.
You're entirely correct. Mr. Chair, Dr. Davis-Wilson, that is entirely correct. And last year around this time, the governor issued an executive order that states that a rulemaking agency or an agency with rulemaking authority, for every new rule that you are proposing, you are required to suggest the elimination of three other rules. So I have done a little bit of review in that spirit, trying to identify what rules, you know, could potentially be sacrificed if we determined that we wanted to adopt new rules. We're always going to have that be held to a standard where, you know, we are not, we have to justify the rule change in terms of this is not imposing, you know, a new requirement, certainly not a new cost or a new burden or a new hurdle and so forth. So all of those things have to be considered, you know, as we move forward, when we move forward.
Mr. Chair, I think you're on mute.
Thank you. So given the recommendations from Dr. Davis-Wilson and Ms. Pakanon, I'm wondering if, Ms. Pakanon, if you don't mind, do you, would you like to reserve that discussion of your list at the time that we do discuss the rules? And if there are no comments or overall concerns from the people, from the committee and stakeholders, we can move on to the next agenda item. Is that okay? Is there any objection to that? And then Ms. Galvin, do we need a motion to do that?
No, there's a consensus with the committee that this will be tabled until we get some news on legislation or until the committee decides otherwise.
Okay, sounds good. So we'll table that and we'll move on to agenda item number 6. Discussion with stakeholders and consideration of possible action regarding licensure and regulation as it relates to the entire scope of practice of behavior analysis in Arizona. So, Ms. Pakanon, did you want to make any opening comments to that, or do you want me to? Or
Mr. Chair, you're probably better versed on the intent of this agenda item. I know that the discussions that the CBA has held, you know, recently reflects that, you know, as this young profession continues to embrace its and recognize its scope of practice, it may be that that scope is more vast than the statutes and rules actually address. So if there are practice areas that aren't effectively addressed by the statutes and rules, and in the process, that failure to address them puts the public potentially at harm, that's, I think, at least part of the intent of this discussion.
So Ms. Pakanon just summarized the whole thing for us. So thank you, Ms. Pakanon. You pretty much nailed it right there. To the stakeholders, we've had comments in the committee regarding the evolution of behavior analysis in Arizona. And those of you who've gone through programs know that the behavior analysis is widespread. I mean, we cover several different industries, but part of our discussion is related to those people that are practicing, for example, organizational behavior management, for Bank of America, for example, or those that are working in sports. And it, you know, for the most part in the state of Arizona, the focus has been primarily on autism service provision and expanding to other areas of developmental disabilities. But we've had an ongoing conversation about what do we do about these industries that are developing in the state of Arizona, and how does licensure affect them? And so part of it is, you know, one of the reasons we wanted you in on the conversation is to explore that and have a discussion of where do you see behavior analysis expanding? What does that mean for licensure? Does it mean that we need to pursue licensure? And how are some ways that we can help protect the, let's just, for example, the corporate public of, you know, in the practice of behavior analysis? And there was a comment made earlier that there are people that are doing OBM and that aren't necessarily licensed. And there's people that if you were to operationalize it, are doing OBM, which in general is a, you know, at least from our field, we would call that a behavior analytic activity. You know, people that are working in the corporate world actually would call that management. You know, or HR or whatever. And so there's that, you know, confound that's occurring, but we wanted, you know, your viewpoint on that too, and committee viewpoint on that of, you know, how might that be addressed through licensure? Does it need to be addressed through licensure? you know, are they in fact practicing behavior analysis? We had a conversation earlier about teachers and beefy babes who happen to be teachers and is in the scope of practice. And so we'd like your feedback on that. And then committee members, if you feel, if you want to convey anything, please speak up too. So.
This is Carrie Baranek. I see that I'm the only stakeholder on the call, of course, for this very easy softball question. My response is this question is bigger than me and will require a great deal of conversation among not just AZABA, but maybe other professional organizations that engage in some of these activities. But I'm really happy that we're bringing this up. And I mean, what a good problem to have, right? That our practice has expanded outside of the realm of autism. That's a nice problem to have.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I agree. It's a big topic. And I think Carrie, just to kind of help you out a little bit, I think this is going to be an ongoing topic for a very long time. But it's one that I appreciate Dr. Senhoff bringing it forward, and especially when it comes to what we would do about training programs and supervision and what all of that would look like, and understanding that, again, just if I think about OBM, like certification is not even required. So we could have, you know, somebody that's graduated from Western Michigan that's doing, you know, it's not one in the same, but you know, in psychology, they have the industrial and organizational psychology, and we don't license those folks. So I think that we have a little bit of conversation to have, even with psychology alone, of are they able to call themselves, you know, psychologists? What is the restriction of that? Is there anything in their exclusions of licensure, that verbiage that we need to kind of maybe reference and add to our exclusion to licensure? I have some really good friends in the OBM network, and you know, I am a member of the OBM network, and I am active in a lot of the work they're doing, and they're being restricted in practice in certain states. And I think that when you look at our definition of client and you look at our definition of behavior analysis, I think we also may be restrictive in our practice, not as openly as some of the other states. Other states have outwardly said, even if you're an OBM professional, you must meet our licensing standards. Well, for those that aren't certified, that's extremely problematic because they, you know, maybe didn't even do it. There's a lot of issues with it. So I won't even list them all. But so I would argue that, yeah, we probably are a little bit overly prescriptive for that particular practice. But then I would say beyond that, so if we say a more broader health and human services, right? A lot of our services, maybe it's not with autism, but maybe it's, you know, I bring up, I always call Lauren Crum, but that's because she was Crum when I supervised her. But Lauren Klein, you know, who's really big into health, wellness, sports, fitness. Ariana Charos, a BCBA now, I found out, passed her exam, very big into, you know, health, fitness, those sorts of things. They're being twofold, being kind of pigeonholed into experiences of autism, because that's all that is available. And that's a separate kind of practice, you know, profession issue. But two, I think we could still argue and articulate that their clientele is still under that of health and human services. And I think that, I don't know that I would want that to change, but if it weren't to change, then does the makeup of the CBA committee matter? Because if the makeup of the CBA committee is all autism practitioners, and we're now seeing 3, 4, 5, 6 health and wellness, sports and fitness, maybe primary care work, you know, my doctorate was done in primary care offices and the hospital. So, and not with the, you know, not necessarily with the autism population. So are we now looking at, those sorts of things and saying, are we, do we have the makeup as a committee to appropriately do that? And if we don't, a solution could be to work with the board in establishing lists of subject matter experts that the board can, you know, utilize during complaints or what have you. More recently, I've been kind of dealing on a professional level with some agencies that are struggling. You know, the access policy doesn't restrict our services, our behavioral health services to autism, but they're getting referrals for individuals with Down syndrome and other genetic disorders, and that's not everybody's scope of practice. And that is somewhat problematic, I think, one, in addressing the scope of practice issue, which I think communication from the association is going to be, and training and support to stakeholders from the association is going to be important. But I think we have to make sure, one, we're going to be equipped to handle, you know, complaints or issues or questions or whatever, if our board is made up of people who may not have that scope of practice. And two, you know, there's certain things involving various, you know, diagnoses that does make a decision on how treatment is implemented, what goals you use, what testing materials you use. Those sorts of things may matter on the different populations. And so I think there's a lot of like hefty conversation to be had around it. I don't know what direction to go other than I think we need to review that client's definition, make sure that we as a board or as a committee are clear on who we oversee. And I would argue that it is Health and Human Services. We're under the health, like anytime we go to House and Senate, it's all through like their health committee, right? Like, I think that is kind of encompassing of where we are, but do we then piggyback on where psychologists are with the IO industry and make sure that we aren't limiting OBM practice? And what would that look like? I don't know. There's a lot to think and talk about, but definitely something I think we're facing like now today.
Chair.
Yes, Ms. Denton.
I hate to interrupt this very important topic, but I do need to hop off the call. So I request to be excused.
Deny it. I think proper would be to say goodbye or something along those lines.
So. I'm going to learn how to be proper. I will.
She raised her hand, Chair. I mean, look at that. Look at no little eye.
Learning history.
I don't even know if I can do that. I probably hit the wrong hand gesture and cause a problem.
I guess in the matter of voting, Ms. Folks, we still have a quorum, correct? We need to vote, so.
Correct. You do.
All right. Thank you for being here, Ms. Denton, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, goodbye.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Because I don't know if this definition has been, if we revisited it in the context of this discussion, but I'm looking at the definition, so that statute 32-2091, at subsection 3, I'm wondering if that definition of what is behavior analysis is, if it's so broad that it really truly encompasses your entire scope. Do I need to pull that up maybe?
If you would, please, yeah.
Okay. Let's see how successful I can be in this process.
On page 43 of the PDF, if you have that.
And while you're pulling that up, you know, one thing that I have, I've had a few supervisees that have reached out to me to talk about supervision, and I see this at the university programs, but you know, one thing that I just want us to be cognizant of is that a lot of supervision is occurring under the scope of practice of autism. And usually what I tell, you know, there's a couple of students that are in the ASU program first years right now that are interested in other lines of work. And what, you know, I make it very clear in my ethics class that where they do their supervised experience is really where they're going to be practicing. So unless they go and seek additional supervision, and it's kind of going two ways. One, they're either wanting to do something else, but for the sake of getting access to supervisors, they're going the autism route. which is an easy path to licensure. But I do want to be cognizant that if we were to say something like OBM, you know, practitioners don't have to be licensed, what happens when that supervisee does their entire supervision? And I have the, you know, an answer, but they do their entire supervision with an OBM practitioner and then they can't find employment. So they go, you know, to the autism agency. I mean, we would have to be clear that they would have to obtain supervision towards licensure at that point. Like, is that something the psychologists have ran into? I mean, that for me, I think that because taking outside licensure, and let's say we're in California or whatever, that is happening where someone like I'll talk to somebody and or especially like if you look at some of the work that OBM Network's dealing with is these clinicians are being trained in the autism world, but then going out and advertising themselves as BCBAs to Bank of America without that proper training and supervision. And so, I mean, I just think it's something that can rightfully for the protection of public be addressed by saying like, no, if you were supervised by an OBM practitioner, then that was your scope of practice. And if you want to change it to autism, then these are the requirements that you need to meet in order to become licensed. I actually think it adds a much needed delineation and protection. I just want to make sure that everybody's aware that that is an issue that will be coming.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think the reason why I'm at least asking questions about this definition is because we may be required, compelled to go back to the Health Committee of Reference and request an expansion, legislative change to, you know, reflect an expansion of scope if this is not adequately described here. And that's quite a process to go through.
Yeah. I would just say, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Dr. Dane.
Yeah, I mean, as I look at number three, there are, for one, I've never, we are the only, and I've already looked at this, we are the only licensed group in the state of Arizona and beyond that includes a definition of what we don't do in our definition of behavior analysis. Like that for me, that line should be gone from the statute in number three, starting with what it does not include. Second, in number four, the language is problematic in that it refers to us assisting a person. And I think that's where we would be better off re-referencing six, which is what a client is. And a client does have multiple connotations and is already in statute. So I think there's some language cleanup in three and four. I don't know. I mean, I do like the most part of three. There is a much longer definition of what behavior analysis is, but I do believe that this captures it. Should be so long as we get rid of the last full sentence and we clean up some of the language in four. But to this point, I think if we're going to look at any sort of verification of what we're capable of practicing, these two items have to make that statement loud and clear. If you've got your fancy pencil, you can start by like, yeah, right there, behavior, like that whole section. Again, if I remember correctly, there was just this concern that we were going to go out and start doing psychological testing. Well, first off, that, you know, that's not the case. We don't do neuropsychological testing. We're not engaged in hypnotherapy. You know, these were red herrings that were relics of a decade ago. Behavior analysts, if they're engaging in that, that's outside their scope of practice. If they're engaged in hypnotherapy, and they should, you know, that's an issue that would be brought up with whoever oversees our hypnotherapists in the state of Arizona, and to us most likely.
Well, I was going to say, and I think we do have the regulatory authority to address issues in which a behavior analyst may be conducting psychological testing. Like that is, you know, it falls under the unprofessional conduct. It falls under, you know, our ethics code is problematic. Like, I agree. I don't think it needs to be spelled out. And I would argue, you know, there's, you know, a conference coming up this weekend on sex and ABA therapy, because there is a subgroup of behavior analysts that are also certified sex therapists. And so I think to just say that it wouldn't be, to me, that is just a turf war hey, we're gonna throw this out there to say you can't do it when it's already covered in other places of the statute as scope of practice. And I would hate to say, hey, these amazing, you know, people who are duly certified sex therapy and behavior analysis, who can come in and work with a very, very difficult population, whether it's rehabilitating sex offenders, whether it's working with individuals on the spectrum that are, you know, having a need in that area, what have you, but to say like, well, but really you can't do that here, that even though it's within your scope of practice, there's still an actual statute that says you can't do it. I think that it's covered in the fact that if you are doing it and it's not in your scope of practice, there is plenty of other language in the statute that covers that.
I mean, the BACB has even come to the point of where it's started to talk about the terminology they use is like respecialization guidance, right? Because to your point, you know, it's not only health and fitness, it's substance abuse disorder, it's sustainability, education, OBM we already mentioned, gerontology is up and coming, behavioral pediatrics, we're seeing it in sport, as you mentioned. You know, so there's all this, and in clinical behavior analysis as the terminology is coming along. So there's these specialty areas that we're going to have to address. They're already out there. They're already referenced on the BACB's website. There's already guidance on how to kind of become trained in one of those specialty areas. It's probably not hard to make the leap that at some point BCBAs will be able to get a specialty certification from the BACB in education, in brain injury rehab, in those areas based on coursework and supervision and applying for that specialty. It's coming. And so we're going to have to be prepared for that. And it may be more of some discussion with the BACB to align those specialty areas with what we're trying to capture here and making sure we're not missing something.
Well, and I think deciding on what specialty areas would warrant one, the need of licensure and regulation, and two, if it's licensure and regulation, who is responsible for that? Like take the school psychologist, for example, or again, the industry and organizational psychology. There's, you know, a reason why those are not being seen by the clinical psychologist group. And so I think that there could be a time where I think everything else in the statute would be problematic. And I say OBM because, again, our statute talks about confidentiality and records and healthcare and all these other things that have nothing to do with OBM. And yeah, there's other confidentiality things in ethics codes and HR processes and stuff. But I think that in addition to defining those scopes of practice, when the BACB starts to do that, we would also have to make a decision as what would fall under, which scopes of practices then would fall under this board's regulation.
When I look at the list on the BACB, there's 12 of them. I mean, I think OBM comes to mind that would be on that list of it. Probably doesn't fit our current statutes and rules very well. The sustainability group that's looking at kind of climate change, water pollution, air pollution, that group is probably not there. But the others, you know, ASD and DD is there, behavioral gerontology, behavioral pediatrics, brain injury, prevention intervention for child maltreatment, health and wellness or health and fitness, education, clinical BA, sports, and substance abuse. That all falls, in my humble opinion, falls under the health and wellness category and would fall under us. Because if you're treating that sort of a client, in this case, a person in those cases, or a group of persons, then you fall under our purview. If you're treating Bank of America to help them clean up reduction of red tape, use of paper, you know, office space, that to me is not in our purview, and nor should it take the time of this particular committee. Same probably in sustainability. So yeah, I think that opening that up maybe in some general terms about how it links to the health and welfare of clients, that leaves that pretty wide open to us to say, yeah, you know what? Behavioral gerontology clearly falls with us. And you better be able to demonstrate that you've got the training to be engaged in that as a licensed behavior analyst and holding yourself out as an expert in that area.
And to that point, for those professions that do want to, you know, get their you know, get running with the ability to provide those services, the licensure also assists them in securing funding from insurance companies. And if they're going to be billing insurance, it's very difficult to articulate that it isn't a health and wellness service. But I think that Dr. Davey, that goes to where, you know, it says client means, and then a person or entity that receives behavior analysis services. To me, that's a little bit too broad, because that could include Bank of America. Mm-hmm. As it's written right now. I mean,
yeah, it could, because that would be operated at TV. And I guess, you know, to that point, it's like, are you providing a corporate entity? You know, in this case, maybe you're not providing, because I'm trying to think about the governmental side, or organizationals that have professional contracts with med services, but if it's primarily to an organization rather than an individual. Yeah, I mean, it may be that to an organization, I mean, we're just going to have to be careful, though, because what is an organization, right? Is an organization in a private school? Is an organization, like, we don't want to give the wiggle room of, well, hey, I didn't work with one client. I actually was just training a bunch of teachers to do FBAs as a licensed behavior analyst, and they were the client. And I think the BACB does some of that with regards to their definition of client as well. And so we may need to clean up the language in B.
Or another alternative, Dr. Davey, if we want to have it kind of that broad, is that we could propose edits to the exclusions. So then that way we don't have people like saying like, well, I'm gonna practice under this umbrella here because this says that this can be my client, but rather we're saying, here's what a client means. Oh, but if you are an OBM practitioner with X experience and education, you're excluded from this. Just an example.
That may be if you have an OBM certificate. I mean, the term client, according to the BACB, you know, here is broadly applicable to whomever behavior analyst provides services. So whether it's an individual person, parent, guardian of the service recipient, an organizational representative, a public private organization, a firm or corporation. So really, they essentially say, as a, and again, they're certifying, this is not, they're not licensing individuals under the scope that we're talking about. They're trying to capture everybody under that umbrella. I think in our case, we're trying to narrow it down to the health side of the world, right? And that will be our task.
And David, to that point, sorry, Dr. Rates, real quick, to that point, the problem is yeah, they're certifying. They also don't have authority over the OBM professionals not getting certified. So again, where we have a Practice and Title Act that says if you're doing anything in number three, that may be considered behavior analysis and you may be practicing without a license. And so it is a little bit different that, and I'm fine keeping, you know, a more broad client definition, just so long as we're capturing those people in the exemptions then, because to your point, like as a regulatory agency, we do have a level of, I don't mean authority, but we do have actions permitted to us for people outside of just our licensees, where like the BACB, if I'm not certified, I can still call myself a behavior analyst till I'm blue in the face, and the BACB can't do anything about it because they only have jurisdiction over BCBAs. And so I can be a BA and they can't do anything about it. But in Arizona, it doesn't work that way, right? Like whether you're a BCBA or a BA, the practice of behavior analysis requires licensure.
Agreed. Mr. Chair, I want to play devil's advocate just a bit and suggest that in the OBM space, I think we need to be thoughtful of certain things. For example, I have to have spent a lot of time working on safety, and they're implementing interventions directly with employees in an organization. And those interventions may not be that different than interventions we would put in place in other kind of more traditional service areas that we're talking about. And so if we're really talking about protection of the public and implementing behavior analysis, I do think that there are some spaces where there's a lot of alignment there. So I want to be thoughtful that when we say OBM, some of it is not too dissimilar than the practices that we're talking about in behavioral gerontology or DD populations. And I just think we want to be thoughtful of that.
Agreed.
An overextension of, yeah.
Well, and that's where I kind of like the idea of the language and the exclusion, because we could craft the criteria of who would be. So we don't have to keep it as broad. I mean, I use OBM as an example, because I agree. You could be OBM doing OBM work in a hospital in safety, right? Fall risks. And now all of a sudden you are in healthcare. And depending on the funding of the hospital, especially like a federally qualified health home, they are being funded by insurance companies. So I would agree. There's a lot of different funkiness to it. But I kind of feel like that can be better addressed in the exemptions. If we're going to say OBM provider working on HR type subjects like staff retention at Bank of America, or cost reduction through, you know, whatever, like, not that we would have it that prescribed, but I think in exemptions, we could say practitioners, you know, practicing under this type of work wouldn't necessarily need to be licensed, rather than saying we exclude OBM practitioners. Or defining it in such a way that it excludes OBM. I think that, and again, I have concerns of the jumping of fields, right? Where, I mean, if you go into any forum, there's a lot of autism providers saying, how do I get into OBM? How do I get a job in OBM? Well, first of all, you got to be trained and supervised and qualified, and you don't just get a job because you're a BCBA. So I think that's why I'm wondering if that exclusions piece, where we could really define the Aubrey Daniels, and he does safety work, but still, you know what I mean? Point being, he's not a certified behavior analyst, but he is, you know, well known in OBM type work. Or you look at Abernathy, who's no longer with us, but his work is all in performance pay. Is there really a safety concern in performance pay? I mean, some could argue that it's, you know, affects mental health, but that's a stretch, right? So I think that if we could craft, you know, like what the Aubrey Daniels Institute does and some of those other groups that do some safety, but you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Chair, we have just placed two student interns with the board, and one of whom is charged with a pretty ambitious research agenda, but we can task her potentially with looking at the other states that regulate behavior analysis to capture how do they define their scope. And also, I guess the corollary to that would be, you know, what they exempt from the practice of behavior analysis. Would that be useful to this committee?
Yeah, I think we should definitely have them work on that.
Okay.
And perhaps the BACB and APBA might have some, because they, you know, both groups do quite a bit of work around model licensing acts. Maybe this is something that they've had thoughts or discussions or internal conversations about that perhaps they would have feedback on as well.
I'll pull the Model Licensing Act. It's the BACB is no longer involved in it. It's all held by the APBA.
But I think that the last time we crosswalked it, our language is very similar. And so I think it's more of, have they had discussion about those populations? Mm-hmm. Because I think their Model Licensing Act work is for the purpose of securing insurance funding. I don't know that the model licensing, similar to what we have, I don't know that it captures anything outside of healthcare either.
So, Mr. Chair, would that then be that information be best gathered by having a subject matter expert come present to this group at a future meeting?
Yeah, I think that might be helpful. Yeah, I think that would be helpful. Committee, thoughts on that? Yeah. Okay, I'm looking. I have to jump off in 8 minutes for another meeting. So Ms. Baranek, you also get to decide how we're going to deal with supervision and across all your peers or colleagues across Arizona and behavior analysis, how we're going to promote more training and all that. So my recommendation is, let's say any more comments on the scope of behavior analysis and practice in Arizona at this point for anybody?
I just have two names I'm going to throw out there as potential people that might give us some perspective that might be useful. Nick Weatherly, because you know, he is a BCBA, but he is an OBM practitioner. However, he's very familiar with OBM and also the other applications. Mm-hmm. And also Dan Sundberg is another one. You know, he does OBM in real estate, but all of his family, I think there's 8 total that are autism practitioners as well. So I just wanted to throw those two names out there as maybe some people that might just be interested in giving us some perspective of the different variations in practice.
Okay.
Related to safety, specifically DJ Moran would be another one.
Okay. All right, so do we want to discuss at the next meeting, add that to an item for discussion of when we might have these people come and if they are in fact available? Okay. All right, okay, so given that we have 6 minutes left and our list of stakeholders is an N of one now, unless Ms. Baranek wants to field all of this information, you know, the point of this, of the latter items were discussions with stakeholders. Ms. Baranek, I don't know if you're interested in conversing about all these topics or if we could move forward and table them for future discussion and arrange with stakeholders to discuss this in the future. Is there any preference among anybody for one of those options?
I have a strong preference to table.
Okay.
But I will say that I'm taking good notes. There's a public policy committee meeting on Monday, so it's very well timed. Okay. And I will be, I'm sure also Kyle and Raquel will be taking all of these issues to the committee for dissemination and for discussion. So we would love the opportunity to be invited back to discuss further.
Okay. Well, if there's no objection, I would recommend that we move to item number 10, but I'll wait for response on that.
I have no objection, but I think that for the other items too, it might be helpful, Ms. Baranek, to possibly hear that some of the items discussions aren't just, I mean, they're regulation and public policy in nature, but some of it is going to be kind of a way to collaborate on how we educate the stakeholders on that. So I don't know if representatives from your program committee or one of the other committees might be something that you might want to loop them in, because I think we want to have a robust conversation around these patterns of things that we're seeing that you guys might be interested in continuing education opportunities for your members.
Yes, thank you. And even some of our special interest groups, for example, we have an SIG committed to expanding the scope. So this would be apropos to that discussion.
Yeah. So I think if you guys wouldn't mind, like, these are public meetings, they're being held in the public meeting forum. So you can invite those SIG leaders, you can invite the other committee members that would be pertinent to these, if that's helpful in kind of helping with those topics. Just wanted to throw that out there.
All right. Any other discussion on that? Okay. So let's move to agenda item number 10, new agenda items for future meetings. We had a few listed in there. One was the potential of having some area experts discuss behavior analysis within those fields. We also wanted to discuss the definition of behavior analysis in part. There was a few other items listed there. Ms. Pacana, did you make note of those? I don't have those.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the one that I can think of immediately is the further discussion on 2091.15, which is okay. Describes the committee.
Okay, great, yes, definitely. Okay. All right, any other agenda items from the committee?
So Mr. Chair, if I understand correctly, so we're going to schedule a follow-up, we'll call it a special meeting where mm-hmm. We pick up with the same agenda items that were on this agenda, stakeholders are invited. So this that special meeting may be a couple of months out.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Yep. Okay. Okay, hearing no suggestions, let's move to agenda item number 11, adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? All right, meeting is adjourned. Nice work.